Good morning, everyone. Welcome. So the goal for this year, which it's a little bit ambitious to cover 1,000 years in 2.5 hours, we will take one break somewhere around the year 1550, right around, maybe 1450, right around the printing press. We'll take a quick pause. But the truth is that the goal of this year is not to teach history. It's not to teach a particular sugya. It's really, the goal is to grow in our emuna. That's really the purpose of this presentation. And that, for me, the more that you connect to the great rabbinic personalities and the Mesorah and the tremendous amount of Torah learning that existed throughout the generations, you can't help but be inspired. It can't not impact you on a personal level and a person's growth and their connection to Hashem. And I find that even on questions of emunah, particularly when you speak about emunah, you mean, you know, more philosophical questions. So people have questions, and questions are important. But when you realize that people before you, and such great people before you, have dealt with questions, these questions, and that you're part of something much bigger, I think it helps, at least it helps me, deal with certain questions when it comes to emunah. So what we have here is the 1,000 years are broken down into 5 packets, which you have in front of you. The blue packet is the first one. Each packet covers 200 years. And we're going to touch upon 5 figures from each of these 200-year periods and a little piece of Torah that they shared. Now, we're not going to do this in any great depth. It's somewhat cursory, but this survey is hopefully going to give us a greater appreciation. Now, I begin with Hakara Satov. I begin with a measure of gratitude. Perfect timing. The first person who deserves Hakara Satov, thank you, my wife, Nechama, for letting me take the time to prepare this and deliver it, and many other things. I owe a tremendous amount of gratitude to YU, because when I was still in Azrieli, which is a teaching graduate school, I was permitted, they gave me a special dispensation to sign me into a class with Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik. And Dr. Soloveitchik taught us the introduction to the Rishonim. Now, that class was frightful, I will tell you, and there are many anecdotes that I could share if we didn't have a very short amount of time, but it was an incredible experience, and I definitely owe the concept of this year, the structure and the meaning of it, to that experience. I definitely learned more in that class than I learned at least in terms of the relevance to the learning that I have now, than any other class that I ever took anywhere. It was unbelievable. It was like a life-changing experience. So I owe that tremendous debt of gratitude to YU and to Dr. Soloveitchik. That in mind, if he ever heard what is about to be said, he would kill me. So please, don't tell him that this ever happened, because the thought for him of me discussing Rashi in 5 minutes is a crime. And in a certain sense, that's the apology that I'm going to give, which is, it is a little bit of a crime, what we're going to do this morning, which is to really appreciate these great giants of Torah. We'd need a few years, a few semesters. So what we're doing is a crime in that sense. And it's also, you know, I don't want a situation where I go to sleep tonight and, you know, the Netziv comes to me in a dream and he says, "You cut me from the list? Like, who are you?" You know, like, why was I chopped? You know, like, the Re is going to be like, "So who do you think you are?" So I'm not trying to suggest that these are the major, most important figures. They help us tell the story of Jewish history from a learning standpoint, from a development of learning standpoint over the course of these many years. But this is not an exhaustive list. This is just Al Ktzei HaOmer, Ktzei HaMazleik, as they would say. Okay, so let's begin with our first figure in the blue packets, and that is Rashi. Rashi is born in the year 1040, and he is educated. This is going to be our first and most important map for right now. This is Germany right here, and France right here. Rashi is born in Troyes. If you travel to Troyes today, you will find a small town with French peasants. My parents gave me a gift. They sent me there to study French Jewish history with YU for a couple of weeks. I went there. There is a monument to Rashi's memory in this French town. You can Google it, you'll see it. But Rashi was not educated in Torah. At this point, in the middle of the 11th century, the great halachic works, everything that was being discussed in the Rhine Valley communities in Germany, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. So Rashi studied in Worms, in Mainz, and three teachers, most of whom, they were primarily students of Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGola. We don't have time to talk about today. Rabbeinu Gershom did write a small commentary on some of the tractates of the Gemara. But what happens toward the end of the 11th century, Rashi moves back to Troyes. And he moved back in Troyes, and that's a crucial development, because what happens in 1096? The Crusades. So all of the Rhine Valley communities, especially these three major centers, are completely crushed and wiped out. But Dr. Soloveitchik points out that in truth, even though it was a devastating blow, and we're going to mourn it on Tisha B'Av, it didn't actually destroy the development of Torah learning, because Rashi had already moved back to France, and he had established students, both his family members, his children, he had three daughters, and several sons-in-law, and their children, they became the great rabbinic luminaries of their time in France. So actually, even though the Crusades is destroying everything that's happening in Germany, largely the learning in France is intact. So we're going to move over for a second. We don't know exactly what Rashi did. At that time, they didn't have farms. They weren't landowners. So maybe he was a merchant, maybe something. But Rashi's living in Troyes, and he has several students. And like I said in the beginning, we're going to try to condense this even beyond what it was originally condensed. We'll try to move through it somewhat quickly. Rashi had one very important disciple, so to speak, although he wasn't directly a disciple of Rashi, and that was Rabbeinu Tam. That's the next person in the packet. We're going to tackle them both in one. That's Rabbeinu Yaakov ben Meir, who was the grandson of Rashi, the son of Rav Meir ben Shmuel. And Rabbeinu Tam, he creates a revolution in Torah learning. Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam both changed the face of Torah study forever in two different ways. Rabbeinu Tam is living in Ramarot, which is around here. It's not on this map. But Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, they're living in this area around Paris, which becomes the center of Jewish learning in the 12th and the 13th centuries. This is where everything is happening. Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam have two different jobs, and this is each one of them brings something to the table. Before Rashi, there were sparse commentaries on the Talmud and on the Chumash, but nothing was systematic the way that Rashi wrote several pamphlets. So Rashi was the first one who committed to writing pamphlets that were methodologically arranged according to the whole all of Shas and Tanakh, almost all of Tanakh. There's the difference between Rashi and Tosfos in the following analogy. Right now, if you come here to Timber Ridge, so the next street over from us is Tamaroa. It's being repaved by the village of Skokie. So there are two people who are in charge of paving the road, really responsible for paving the road in the village of Skokie. And the same thing goes for the potholes. You know, like in the summertime, the pothole crews come out. So there are two people who take care of paving the roads and the potholes. The first guy is the big, sweaty guy who wears that, you know, the light orange reflector vest, who's actually out there paving the road and smoothing out every single bump. Then there's another guy who sits in the village office, and he looks at the map with all the different roads, and he figures out, well, wait a second, if we dig in this street, what's it going to mean for the next water main on the next road? How does the impact of this construction project here, how does it touch something that's going on somewhere else? How do they intersect? This is the difference between Rashi and Tosfos. I'm not trying to say that Rashi is the sweaty guy, but in a certain sense, Rashi's job is to tell you exactly what's on the page. And that's what I shared with you, this one Rashi. It's the first of several. Rashi says in the beginning of Bereshis, in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Ches, about how Adam and Chava, they heard the voice of Hashem going in the garden. Rashi says, Yesh midrashe agada rabim. There are many midrashe agada. Ukvar sidrum rabuseinu amuchonam. Rashi was an expert in medrash, which is the homiletic teachings of the rabbis, the period of the mission at the Talmud. And they're connected in Bereshis Rabba b'shar midrashos. Vani and I, lobasi el lefshuto shel mikra. I came for the pshuto shel mikra, which is a loaded explanation, question what that expression means, how to explain that. Ula agada hamiyasheves divrei hamikra davar dibur al ofanav. And to the homilies, the agadata that explains hamiyasheves divrei hamikra, the words of the verses, each one on their place. That's my job. You have a text, and my job, Rashi says, is to smooth it out. Either giving you the pshat. Now there is a book by Rav Yehuda Cooperman, the founder of Michlala, called Lifshuto Shel Mikra, where he tries to analyze exactly how Rashi understands the word pshat. Maybe it means the primary intent of the author, but whatever it is, that's Rashi's job, and that's what you see in Rashi on the Shas. Rashi's job is to figure out what does this piece mean in the local context. What do you need to know to understand this phrase, this principle? That's his job. And on the Chumash, he adds to give you the Agadata. But the Rabbeinu Tam is exactly the opposite. The Rabbeinu Tam created a revolutionary way of learning Gemara, and that was called the dialectic method. That's the innovation of Rabbeinu Tam. So here's an example on your page from Rabbeinu Tam where the dialectic method leads to a very important conclusion. The Gemara here, which is in Pesachim Daf Tzadi Dalid, the Gemara says that the time it takes, Mishkiyas Hachama Va'ad Seisa Kochavim, from Shkia is sunset, until Tesa Kochavim, until the stars come out, that is Arba'as Milin. It's the time it takes to walk 4 mil. How long does it take to walk a mil, which is a measure of distance? So it's not so clear. Let's assume right now it's 18 minutes, even though that's debatable, but let's assume it's 18 minutes. So according to this Gemara, how long does it take from Shkia, sundown, until Tesa Kochavim stars out? How long does it take? 72 minutes, right? That's what you see from this Gemara. So far, so good. And yet, if you look on the side, here is the Tosfos. Tosfos says, Kasha la Rabbeinu Tam, in the double underline, Rabbeinu Tam has a question, Desof b'mem adlikin, in the end of the second parak in Shabbos, Amar, it says, Ezu ben ashmashos, when is ben ashmashos, this interim period, Mishetish kahakama, kolz man, shepenei mizrach ma'adimin, from the time the sun sets, until it is red in the skyline. And the Gemara says, how long is that? It has two opinions. And the conclusion of the Gemara is 3/4 of 1 mil. Wait a minute. You tell me over here in Pesachim that from Shkia until Tseis is 72 minutes. How long is 3/4 of 18 minutes?
12 minutes.
13.5 minutes. Wait a second. How can it be that you told me over there it's 72 and over here it's 13.5? This is a classic dialectic method question of Tosfos. This is the revolution of Rabbeinu Tam. The interesting thing is, before I take this any further, is Rabbeinu Tam himself wrote almost nothing. He wrote the Sefer HaYashar, some responsa, but not much. He had a student, and this is where this map, which you can take a look at later, which is an amazing encyclopedia done by a guy by the name of Rafal Halperin, who was a student of the Chazon Ish, and then he became a professional boxer, and then he went back into learning. He was an interesting, apparently interesting character. He wrote an encyclopedia called Eitz Chaim. And what you see here, and even you could just appreciate it from afar, is this begins at the year 940, and it travels till the year 1492, and it's the relationship between teachers and students, and the transmission of Torah. So you see Rashi is here, and Rashi had several of his sons-in-laws, and one of them was the teacher of Rabbeinu Tam, or Rabbeinu Tam here, you see, he's going to fan out, he's going to have an explosive number of students and a huge influence. This line here is France and Germany, Provence we'll talk about, Spain, North Africa, Italy, Babylonia, and Israel. That's how it's aligned. So you can see, as well, and we'll talk about it as we go a little further. So Rabbeinu Tam, he doesn't write much down. He has one student, his prime chief disciple. He has several, but one chief one, that's Rabbeinu Yitzchak of Dampier, who's living, Dampier is not far from here, not far from Amaron, Tois, all in the same area near Paris, Tsarfas. The Re learns all the teachings of Rabbeinu Tam, the whole dialectic method, but he also doesn't write much down. He has four primary disciples. The most well-known is the Rash of Sens, Shans, Rav Shimshon Mishans. These are all names of French towns. They're also the names of famous Tosafists. Rabbeinu Yom Tov of Orleans, Rabbeinu Yom Tov of Jonyi, Rabbeinu Shimshon Rifalais, Rabbeinu Meshulam of Melun, Rabbeinu Rash, Rabbeinu Shimshon Mishans. So Rash Mishans wrote down the teachings of his teacher, Rabbeinu Yitzchak, who heard all the dialectic method from Rabbeinu Tam. So this Tosfos is authored by the Rash Mishans, who is a student of the Re, who was a student of the Rabbeinu Tam, who knew everything that Rashi had taught, that was his grandfather, and now he's going to challenge these assumptions. So how does Rabbeinu Tam resolve this problem? I'm sorry, I can't take questions at the moment because we'll get through only about 150 years. So We'll take questions at the way end. How does Rabbi Nutam resolve this contradiction? How does he deal with the dialectic? He says, okay, so here's what my suggestion is going to be. My suggestion is the following. When we talk about Shkia, it's not what we thought it was. We thought that Shkia meant Shkia Zachama, when the sun goes down. That's not what it means. There are two Shkias. The first time is when the sun goes down, but that's not important. That's not significant. You know what's significant? When the light disappears from the horizon. That's significant. So that's going to be 58 and a half minutes after sundown. Because what Rabbi Nutam does is he says, look, you said there was 72 minutes and you said there was 13 and a half minutes. What you really must have meant was the last 13 and a half minutes, that is Bein Hashmashos. So according to Rabbi Nutam, from sundown for 58 and a half minutes, you could be driving around on Friday afternoon because it's absolutely day. Only once it's 13 and a half minutes till the end, till what he calls Seis HaKochavim, this is Sof Shkia, then it becomes Bein HaShmashos. Fast forward, this is not the only opinion. Fast forward several hundred years, the Vilna Gaon says, wait a minute, I have a different way of resolving that contradiction. But because this was the way that Rabbeinu Tam resolved the contradiction, he came up with a creative, halachic, new ruling that permitted people, he wasn't the first one to say this, but he made it most famous. It was also in the Gaonim before him. But he strengthened and codified this position. So it took Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zichrono Livracha, is going to have to pick up the phone on the Lower East Side and call one of the great Rabbanim of Williamsburg and say, okay, maybe in Poland you guys were doing malach on Friday afternoon, 50 minutes after sundown, but in the Lower East Side, we can't have this. We can't have Hasidim who are following the Rabbeinu Tam driving when we're walking home from shul. We got to come up with some. But how did this originate? It all originated with Rabbeinu Tam. Had not been for Rabbeinu Tam, this shita would not have become popularized. It wouldn't have become taken root in the mainstream halacha. So this is an example of where the dialectic method of the Rabbeinu Tam changes the face, and it's true in many, many examples. This is just one example, and it's very practical. That's why, if you go to certain shtiblach in the summertime, they're not going to make havdalah until when? Very late, not just 72 minutes, because many achronim say that when you develop this system of figuring out the mil, how long it takes to walk a mil, so some achronim say it depends on the shows manios, the hours of the day depending on what the season is. So if it's the summertime and you're in the camp, Rabbi Mordechai Willich Shlita, he points out that he lives in Riverdale, once pointed out in an article that it could be if you're in a high latitude, like where we are, in the summertime, you could be waiting 100 minutes, 120 minutes, 140 minutes, until you make Havdalah on Saturday night, because if you're following Rabbeinu Tam. This is all the revolution of the Rabbeinu Tam. So this is second section. We move on. We translate our discussion from the world of Chachmei Ashkenaz, Germany and France, over to the world of the Chachmei Sfarad. And here we're going to address the Rambam. So obviously you could talk for weeks and weeks just about the Rambam himself. The Rambam was born in 1135 in Cordova, which is here. If you look on the map, Cordova is toward the south of Spain. Now, the difference between the white and the gray is that the white, the southern end of Spain, is Muslim Spain at this point. Now, there was a conquest of Spain by the Muslims from the south moving toward the north. This area up here is France. France is the eldest daughter of the church. It's always Christian. And this area, this is called Provence. Provence is the southern crust of Spain, the southern crust of France, just north of Spain. So this always maintained its Christian identity. But during several centuries, there was a push of Muslims moving north into Spain, and then ultimately there was the reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula by the Christians into the 13th century. But this is going to be important for the different Rishonim who are living there. So the Rambam's father was a dayan in Cordova. He was a student of a very important Spanish rabbi by the name of Rimi Gash. However, at a young age, they had to run away from Spain because there was a group of extremist Muslims called the Almohads who were persecuting Jews. So he left there, he went to Fez for 5 years. He traveled from Fez, eventually they traveled across the Mediterranean. They landed in Israel, and ultimately he settles in Egypt. The Rambam wrote several major important works in addition to some minor works. He wrote medical treatises, 30-some medical works. The Rambam wrote in his youth a Pirush on Mishnayos. The Rambam wrote the Mor Nevuchim, a philosophical work. And again, I apologize for moving so quickly. We don't have time for more biographical, interesting details. And then the Rambam wrote his perhaps most important work, the most monumental work of his life, and that is the Mishnah Torah. The Rambam took he took the entirety of Torah, and he says in his introduction, he says, look, Jews are being persecuted all over the place. We got to figure out how to put it into your hands so you can keep it with you. All you need to know as a Jew for Kol Torah Kula, including Kodshim and Taurus, every single aspect of Torah, is in this book. All you need are two things. You need a Tanakh, and you need my book. That's it. That's what he wrote. That's what he writes in the introduction. So this revolutionized Torah study in several ways. So if you want to read more about the Rambam, Dr. Isidore Twersky, also known as the Tolna Rebbe Harav Yitzchak Asher Twersky, Zichron Levracha, who was the champion of Jewish studies in Harvard by day. He was a Chassidish Rebbe at night. But he has two works on the Rambam. The first is called, well, first he translates all of the Mishnah Torah into English and it kind of frames it. And then he has another work called the Maimonides, A Maimonides Reader. And that's where he picks out seminal and interesting selections from all over the Rambam's works, the Rambam's letters, and different pieces where you can get a sense of the Rambam. So what I did was, I wanted to share with you what he says, what he, Dr. Twersky, who's an expert in the Rambam, he describes what are the five unique characteristics of the Yad HaZakah, and then I'll share with you one Rambam. One of the challenges in preparing this year is like, how do you decide? You can only pick one Rashi, one Rambam, one Rabbeinu Tam. It's very difficult, but hopefully these examples teach us something about who they were, what they taught us, or what their methodology impacted in terms of the development of the Torah. So the first thing he says is the Rambam's language. The Rambam did not write the Yad HaZakah in Aramaic. He didn't write, which is Talmudic. He did not write it in Biblical Hebrew. He wrote it in Mishnaic Hebrew. Very simple Hebrew, so it was easily accessible. Number two, arrangement and classification. Meaning, he doesn't follow the order of the Mishnah, he doesn't follow the order of the Talmud, he came up with a new arrangement and what he calls a topical pedagogical arrangement that would be educationally sound and not disturb the content in any way. Number three, codificatory form. The Rambam chose to present the material in crisp, concise form, in little halachos, bite-sized pieces, so it moves at a quick clip. He doesn't bring sources, he just gives you the bottom line. Four, the scope. One of the truly revolutionary aspects of the Mishnah Torah is its all-inclusive scope, obliterating accidental distinctions between the practical and the theoretical. And then five, which is what we're going to focus on, is the fusion of halacha and philosophy. So as part of the overall unity of learning, the Rambam tried to bring about the unity of practice and concept. Meaning, even though it's a halachic work, it's a strictly halachic work, the Rambam includes components of philosophy in this work. So, for example, the halacha that you have in front of you. This halacha, if you want to look at something obscure, this is a good place to look. It's in the end of Hilchos Isurei Mizbeach. Isurei Mizbeach is all about things that are not allowed to be offered as a sacrifice. So the Rambam says that, he quotes based on the Mishnayos, that there is a hierarchy in terms of different kinds of oil that can be used on the menorah and also for menachos. And the Rambam writes in Halacha Yud Aleph, the last halacha in Isurei Mizbeach, which is, by the way, the place that you will find many of these halachos / philosophical comments. Umeachar shekulon ksheirin lamenachos. And after we know that all of these are kosher for menachos, all of these oils, laman nimnu, why are they included? Why are they counted? Kedei leida, so that you should know, says the Rambam, she'ein lamala mimenu v'hashave v'hapachos. You should know that there is a hierarchy. Sheharotze liskos atzmo yichov yitzro, yachov yitzro, hara v'yarchev liyado v'yavi karbonu m'neyafa ha-meshubach v'yoser v'shaba'oso ha-min shiyavi m'menu. You want to do the right thing? You should bring the best karbon. A person should fight their tendency to be stingy, to be narrow, and open up. The reason, says the Rambam, that I gave you this hierarchy is so that you should know, don't be satisfied with the lowest common denominator. Look for something greater. And now the Rambam says, Hari ne'emar b'Torah, it says in the Chumash, Vehevel hevi gam hu mibachoros tono mechalveim, Vayisha Hashem el hevel v'amin chasa. So the Rambam gives you a little drasha, a little Shabbos morning drasha from Parshas Bereishis. Hevel brought the better carbon, so God answered him. So the Rambam uses this as the place, the locus classicus, we could say, to teach you the law, what we would refer to as Zekeli Va'anveyu. You know why you have to have a beautiful sukkah? You know why you have to have nice dishes for the Seder table. You know why you have to have a nice talis? Because of this halacha and this Rambam. It's interesting. Now, many Rosh Yeshiva for generations are going to make a living why the Rambam chose this to be the place, why they chose this verse, Kol Chelev, which is what he quotes in the end, not the Gemara's verse of Zekeilim Aveu. There are going to be a lot of Torahs to be said about this Rambam. But what's the biggest statement about this Rambam, what's important, at least from us for right now, is that the Rambam chose a very halachic context to teach us the message that we should always strive for more ambition in our service of Hashem. We should strive to bring and do the best. And it's a fusion of halacha, of strict law, and philosophy. And he does this in many places, in the end of Hilchos Me'ilah, all these like very obscure places, he tucks away, not just in Hilchos Deos about character, in many places he sticks these things, these comments and these teachings in. Okay, next, we move on. We're still in Spain. We meet a very important rabbinic figure. One of the things that you should consider when we finish this year, or even when we don't finish this year, who would you meet? If you had to choose one person in the last 1,000 years that you could invite for a cup of coffee, who would it be? So someone asked me this question last week when I was preparing, and I told them it would be the Ramban, the next person we're going to meet. The Ramban, he plays a crucial role in many aspects in Jewish history. Happens to be that his Spanish name was Bonestrog de Porta. How many people know the Ramban's name was Bonestrog? And you know what? It makes me feel much better because my English name is Bruce. It could have been Bonestrog. You know what I'm saying? So it's good. So the Ramban was born in 1194. He was born in a very important time and in a very important place. This is Provence, southern France. Provence has essentially a very big disconnect between what's going on in northern France. We'll talk about that in a little more. However, after several scores of years, the teachings, the methodology, and the learning that's going on in France is going to start trickling down through Provence. Now, Ramban, remember, is here in this line. He's squarely in France because he's born and he's raised and he lives in Girona, which is right here in Christian Spain, just north of Barcelona. However, you notice that that's not far off from these southern French towns of Perpignan and Narbonne and others. So Ramban changes the world. He changes the world because he had a teacher. His name is Rav Nassim ben Meir of Trinquetai. Trinquetai is a no-name town. It's a small hamlet in Provence. But it was because Ramban's teacher, if you took a tiny look over here in this, you see there's tiny letters, Nassim ben Meir, off the sefer called Shar HaTfisa. But wait a second. He was a student of Ritzbah, who was one of the Abalei HaTosfos, who was a student of, eventually, of Rabbi Nutan. So Ramban is the first one to introduce to the world of Sfarad the teachings of the Balei HaTosfos. And this changes the world of learning, because all of a sudden now, everybody, all of his students, Rashba and Ritzba and many others, all of a sudden now they have access to the whole approach, the methodology, and the Torah Chidushim that were going on in France. It changes the world. So the Ramban introduces that. The Ramban also was a poet. Part of the challenge of learning Ramban's works is because the Ramban at heart was really a giant poet. So many of his prose, quote-unquote, works are layered with references and other, you know, poetic types of styles. Ramban wrote several halachic works, and most famously was, you see, at this area of Spain, this is Catalonia and Aragon. King James of Aragon was, he was incited, he was pushed. He demanded that there be a disputation in Barcelona with Pablo Cristiani. In the later years of the Ramban's life, the Ramban had disputed this apostate, and then the Ramban vanquished that he won. It was acknowledged by the king that he won this debate. However, when the Ramban wrote the Vikuach HaRamban, then that really got the Dominicans and the Franciscans really angry, and they petitioned the Pope, who then pressured King James of Aragon. The Ramban was supposed to be executed, but what did he do? He was commuted to be exiled. He traveled by himself to the land of Israel. And we have letters. The Ramban arrived in Israel in Akko. I'll tell you the exact date. He arrived in Akko the 9th of Elul 1267. The disputation of was in 1263. He was arrived in 1265, the Vikuach HaRamban, that's when he was sent out, and then 1267 he arrives in Israel. When he is in Israel, he finishes his Pirush on Chumash. So here also, he writes poetry, he writes letters. How to pick one Ramban, I don't know. So in preparation for this, I sat down together with one of the amazing resources we have here in Chicago, Rabbi Chaim Tversky. It's a tremendous Talmud Chacham, amazing resource. So I went through the whole thing with him. So I was discussing with him each one, you know, what should I pick? So he says, for sure, you have to pick this Ramban Al HaTorah, which is what I gave you, and we're going to summarize it briefly outside. Ramban finishes his Pirush on Chumash when he arrives in Israel. How do we know this? Because the Ramban writes in a couple of places something amazing. For example, here's one example. Rashi has a difficulty trying to understand where is Kever Rachel? Where is Beis Lechem? So the Pasuk says, Ba'od Kivras Ha'aretz Lavo Ephrasa. It's Kivras Ha'aretz to Ephrat. Well, what does Kivras Ha'aretz mean? I don't know. It's a strange word. It doesn't appear elsewhere in the Chumash. So Rashi struggles to figure it out. Ibn Ezra struggles to figure it out. Ramban knows both of their Pirushim. Because remember, Ramban is here. Rashi is here. So already he knows what Rashi said. Ibn Ezra is up here. He already knows what Ibn Ezra is going to say. So he says, I'll tell you, you're both wrong. I know because I was there. Since I came to Israel, I can see how far it is. So therefore, the Pirush of Kivras Ha'aretz, Lashon Kabir, doesn't mean a great humongous distance because it's really not that far. So the Ramban that I'm sharing with you here is one of the most fundamental Rambans in all of his writings. This is the Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo, where the Ramban, this is the Shevel edition of Ramban. Ramban asks the question, why is it that we do so many mitzvos, Zecher Liyetzias Mitzrayim? Why do we do so many mitzvahs that have mentioning the Exodus? You're talking about the Seder, you're talking about Shabbat, Seichel Yitzias Mitzrayim, you're talking about tons and tons and tons of mitzvahs. So why? So the Ramban answers, and we'll just do it outside because we don't have the time. The Ramban says, you know why? Because once in a while, you're going to have in generations, someone's going to wake up one day and say, you know what? I don't believe in God. Or, I believe in God, but God doesn't really know what's going on. Or, God knows what's going on, but he really is not going to get involved. So what am I going to do, says God? Every 5 minutes for every little heretic, I'm going to go start pulling out my bag of tricks to prove you that I exist. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to prove it once and done. And for that reason, it is essential that every year at the Seder, we recreate the Exodus. Because that is the bedrock. Without the Exodus, without God demonstrating that he controls nature, that he's involved in the world, that he chose the Jewish people, that he plays this role in history, that he can't get involved in everyday lives. So then, every generation, somebody can wake up and say, I don't believe. So for that reason, Ramban says, that's why we do all of these mitzvot rabos. This is a very important Ramban. The last figure in section one we're going to focus on is Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi. Yehuda HaLevi is one of the most prolific philosophers and poets of the world of Sfarad. He's born in 1075. What you have here on the page is a piece of the Sefer HaKuzari. The Kuzari is his philosophical work that describes the story of the Khazars. Which predated him by about 300 years, so it's not a literal translation. I gave you this translation, which is the Kapach translation, just because in case there were any Arabic scholars here, you might want to see it in the original Arabic, which is on the left side of the page. But I don't know anything about Arabic, so I'm just going to go with the right side of the page. The Kuzari is the conversation between the king of the Khazars and a Jew who is supposed to explain to him the Jewish religion. This becomes one of those important philosophical works, the world's works of Machshava, of all time, of all of Jewish history. And there are many, many important philosophical premises that are articulated here. In this particular one, he discusses how do we know that Judaism is right? How do we know that we believe in the Masorah? So he discusses an analogy, how do you know that India exists? I mean, I've never been to India. Anybody here ever been to India? No, so how do we know that it exists? Maybe it's just, so the answer is, well, people have gone to India. You go to O'Hare, you see there's a plane. It says Air India on the tail. So there's probably India somewhere. And people come and they tell us, oh, we were there. So with the more information we get about that place, we know it exists because people have come from there. So imagine, then he takes this, develops it, and we would want to develop it much further. Imagine, I was the only one in this room. Imagine I was the only guy here this morning. And through that door walked a giant leprechaun. A giant leprechaun juggling 4 cups of Dunkin' Donuts coffee. Right? So here comes the giant leprechaun juggling 4 cups of coffee, and I'm the only guy here. So I come home at the end of learning, and I say to my wife, I said, you won't believe what happened in Or Torah this morning. There was a giant leprechaun that walked into the Sol Shulchan, was juggling four cups of coffee.
She says.
I'm not going to say what she says, right? So somebody wakes up one day and says, oh, you know, God spoke to me last night. I live in upstate New York and I found some tablets. Okay. You know, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe, and even if there were three of us, let's say there were three of us, somebody might say, you guys were all drinking too much. But what if there were 600,000 people who all were standing here and we all walked out and were like, I'm telling you, we all saw a leprechaun, giant leprechaun, juggling Dunkin' Donuts coffee. And then you'd be like, you know what? If everybody saw it, you all saw it, you all saw it. What are we going to do? As crazy as it sounds. Could you imagine? God came and spoke to human beings. It's unbelievable. It's hard to even believe that God would care about what we have to do. But that's the whole idea of Judaism, is God cares about us and he's invested in us. So the proof of that is that he came down to speak to us. So that's one of the important observations that the Kuzari has in his development of his philosophy, is that the concept of mass revelation is critical for the authenticity of Torah Judaism. Otherwise, one guy can make up whatever he wants and then come and try to convince other people to believe him. And you know what? If he's good enough at his job, so eventually he can spread and it can spread. But we believe something that's different because the emuna in Maamar Har Sinai. And Ad Kan of section one. Any questions, comments, or observations thus far? We're going to move away from the purple, the blue packet. We're going to move to the pink packet.
I have just one question.
Yes.
What do they do about language? Like, you have Rashi studying Frenchmen studying in Germany. This is before Yiddish.
So they probably knew. They probably knew many different languages. I would suspect. It happens to be that they even spoke different languages in northern France and in southern France and in Provence.
I have a question. Did Rashi flee from Germany because he knew the Crusades were coming, or is just a Shulchan practice that he made?
Probably not. I think he went home. It was before the Crusades. All right. Packet number two. We move to Marami Rothenburg. We're not that far behind schedule. Rav Meir of Rothenburg. So this is one, I would say, maybe the last, or one of the last, of the great Balei HaTosfos living in Germany. He was born in 1215. His students included some very important people who we'll talk about in a little bit. So he's going to be a pivotal figure in the development of the halacha, but and development of Mesorah. But it's also important to note when and where he's living. So he, Rothenburg, is here in Germany, but he spends his youth studying in Paris with Rav Yechiel Mipariz, who's one of the students of the Ri. So here I am on my little chart here, the development. Here's Rabbi Tam. One of the students is Ri Sur Leon, Rabia, Rav Yechiel Mipariz, excuse me, and Rav Shmuel Mifalaiza. So these two scholars become the Rabbeim of Maram of Rothenburg, Rav Meir ben Baruch of Rothenburg. He's studying in Paris in 1240 with these two great rabbinic figures. What happens to Rav Yechiel Mipariz in 1240? He disputes an apostate, Nicholas Donin. What happens 2 years later in Paris in 1242? The burning of the Talmud. So Maram, Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, witnessed his teachers disputing the apostate in 1240, and he witnesses the burning of the Talmud in 1242. And he writes what we have today, which is the Tishma of Kina of Shali Srufa Be'ech. That's written by Maram of Rothenburg. Maram of Rothenburg then travels back to Germany, so he's living in the Rhine Valley. He has several very important students. The first of which is Rabbeinu Osher ben Yechiel, the Rosh, we'll talk about in a little bit. Another one is Mordechai, Rav Mordechai ben Hillel. Another one is Hagos Maimini, who wrote a commentary. It's not kind of a commentary on the Rambam. Look at this development. Rambam is here, so he's going to write his work. After a couple of years, at this time, Rabbeinu Tam, he never hears about Rambam, because Rambam is in Spain, Rabbeinu Tam is in France. But the Rambam's work, by the time Aram Rutenberg gets around, he has already some access, and his students have access to the works of the Rambam that have filtered their way north. So he has a student known as Hagos Maimini, who wrote little comments on the Rambam. It's not really a commentary. It says every time the Rambam says A, he writes, well, in France we do like this. In Germany we have this. So it's kind of like a gloss. It's not really a running commentary. But in 1298, there was a huge massacre for several months in the German
I was saying, this whole Rhine Valley and the German communities along the Rhine, it was called the Rindfleisch Massacres. Happens to be believed that more Jews, numbers of Jews, were murdered in the Rindfleisch Massacres than there were in the Crusades. But it didn't have the same effect in terms of the destruction of the communities, but more Jews were murdered. Included in that massacre was the Mordechai, Rav Mordechai ben Hillel, and that's why, all right, now I'm really taking a double tangent, but that's why if you look in the back of the Talmud, the Shas Bavli, and they have Mordechais, the Mordechai has two different editions, and then there's a third. And they're very, like, little comments. The reason was because the Mordechai was martyred before he compiled his teachings. So the students put it together, the Hagolos Mordechai, and then there's regular Mordechai, because every clippings was a little bit different, the way that it was published. Similarly, Hagolos Maimoni was also murdered in the Rindfleisch Massacres. Now, in this was all going on for the students of Rami Ruthenberg. Of Rothenburg. In 1286, there was a king in this area of Germany. His name was Rudolf the First, and he was broke, so he had a financial problem. So what was his eitzah going to be? What's the best thing to do if you have no money? Tax the Jews. So then the Jews realized, well, we have a problem here. We're going to be taxed, so what should we do? We should leave. They couldn't own land anyway, so they should just move. Well, then what did Rudolf do? He made a rule. No Jews are allowed to emigrate. So now they're stuck. However, many Jews tried to sneak out quietly, and Maram Rothenberg was one of them. So he was sneaking away from Germany through France. He ends up in Lombardy, and he's found out. He's recognized by an apostate who turns him into the local church officials who send him back to Rudolf, who puts him in prison, first in Wasserburg and then in Schwerin. He spends 7 years in prison, and he refuses to allow the Jews to rescue him from prison because of the concern of the Gemara in Gittin that if they do it to him, what are they going to start doing? They're going to do it to the next guy, and it's going to bankrupt the Jewish community. So he spends 7 years in prison. While he's in prison, though, he actually continues to teach. It's more like house arrest in a castle. So his students came to learn with him, and he writes responsa that we have from the castle. When this happens, one of his chief pupils, we'll talk about in a little bit, was the Rush. He runs away from Germany because he doesn't want to get hopped up the same way that he did. Marami Rothenberg dies in prison in 1293. Still, no one ransoms him. Only in 1307, a guy by the name of Alexander Wimpfen ransoms the body of Marami Rothenberg, who spent 14 years now. He's been deceased for 14 years. Ransoms the bones of Marami Rothenberg and buries him in the cemetery in Worms. Zachor Latov. But 14 years, he was not ransomed. What's fascinating about the tshuva that I share with you here from the Budapest edition of the Marami Rothenberg, Shut Maram, is that it tells you something about what was going on in the communities in Germany at that time. In those days, the governments, the Jews didn't, obviously they weren't citizens, the governments essentially established autonomous Jewish councils. And they said to them, look, you guys pay us taxes, but we're not going to deal with every single Jew because you're not citizens. We're just going to treat you as a collective. From your town, collect taxes from yourself. So the Chila came to the Marami Rutenberg from a particular town. Al b'nei ha'ir sheniskashu yachad miktsasan aruban v'samu lahem rosh echad shalom midas kulan. A bunch of guys got together and they said, we're going to appoint a group to be the local town, the mayor, the city council. So Shaila came to Marami Rothenberg, do they have the authority to do that? And Marami Rothenberg says, no, they don't. You can't set taxes. You can't be the authority in your community unless you have the haskama of everybody. You can't just decide, imagine, we're going to sit around here and we're going to say we're going to represent the whole community of Chicago. No, you have to have everybody to buy in if you want to be in charge. But what's so interesting is, A, you see in terms of the response that was going on, we don't know exactly when this was written, if it was written while he was in the tower or not, but the idea that the Jewish communities were struggling with how to organize themselves in the 13th century is, I think, what's, at least very, to me, it's very interesting about this tshuva. We move now back to Provence. We need one important Provence scholar. We should have more, but we don't have time. And that is going to be Meiri. Rabbeinu Menachem HaMeiri, which is in the next in your packet. He's born in 1215. He dies in 1293. He's born in Perpignan, which is right here. Here is Perpignan. It's very, very close to Spain, just at the edge of Provence. Now, keeping in mind, there is a very big difference between northern Spain, that we call Sorfas, France, and Provence. They spoke different languages. This was called the Langue d'Huile, and this was called Languedoc. They were separated geographically, culturally, and also in terms of their learning. Now, the Meiri did have access to the Spanish Rishonim, because they were further to the south. The Meiri knew Rambam, and also the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham David Posker, who we don't have time to talk about today, who lived in Provence, many great Provençal scholars. And then he was also privy to the teachings of the Chachmei Sfara, Chachmei Tzarfas, those from northern France. So he lived in Perpignan, and he taught there. What's fascinating about the Meiri is that he wrote a massive commentary on the Shas called Beis HaBechira that was lost. It was lost for 500 years. No one had access to the Meiri until it turned up. It was published initially by Reb Bezalel Ashkenazi in the Shita Mekubetzes, and then later was published subsequently. So that's one interesting thing. So how do Poskim deal with the Meiri if the Meiri wasn't really part of the halachic discussion for 500 years? That's an interesting question. The other interesting thing about the Meiri is that the Meiri's commentary on the Gemara is absolutely unique. Dr. Soloveitchik pointed out, these are my notes from the class, he pointed out the following, that there's a difference between two kinds of commentaries. One is what he called glossatorial, and the other one is rhetorical. What's the difference? Ramban wrote a commentary on the Shas, right? Rashi wrote a commentary on Shas. Can you learn Rashi without Gemara? Can you learn Rashi without Gemara? No, the whole point is Rashi is a commentary. It's glossatorial. It's a gloss on something else. You can't read later Spanish commentaries, Rashba, Ritva. You can't learn a Ritva without learning the Gemara. It's just a comment on the primary source. Meiri is the first and perhaps only rhetorical commentary on the Shas. What did Meiri do? He includes the Mishnah, he summarizes the Gemara, and then he explains it. So it's so interesting that to learn Meiri, you don't even need a page of Gemara. You just learn the Meiri separately. It's a rhetorical commentary, which is also unique and part of what makes it distinct from other commentaries, and also a question, how do you deal with that? Because it was very unpopular, it wasn't commonly known. So the piece of the Meiri that I'm sharing with you, which is one of several where he makes the same point, is the discussion of Maseches Avodah Zarah. The Gemara in Avodah Zarah discusses many restrictions that Jews have in dealing with non-Jews. Some of them have to do with business. When can you do business with Jews and non-Jews around the time of their holidays? Some of them have to do with haircutting. You can't take haircuts from a non-Jew. We're talking about a Nachri. Maybe you're worried he's going to slaughter you. He's going to murder you. You're talking halachas about Hashavas Aveda, returning lost objects, Jews and non-Jews, all kinds of different things. So it's interesting, says the Meiri, Harbe Ra'inu, Shemispalim al Shebizmanim Elo in Adam Nizar Midvarm Elo Klal. We find, he says, many people are not careful about many of these halachos. They take haircuts from non-Jews and they do business and different things. Oh. So he says on the third line, the difference is Shehim Kulam Leumos Hakadumos Shalohayu Geduros Bedarche Hadasos. All of those laws in the Gemara were spoken about umos, nations, hakadumos, antiquity of antiquity, shelo hayu geduros, they weren't girded, bedarche hadasos, in the ways of religion. He says, look, when the Gemara said akum, ovi kochav mazolos, he's talking about wild pagans. We're not talking about wild pagans today. We're talking about Christians and Muslims. Christians and Muslims, not discussing here whether they're idol worshippers or not, which is the machlokas rishonim about Christians, they at least have a religious framework. We're not concerned that they're going to do the crazy things that the wild pagans did. And therefore, the Meiri is mechadesh that many of the halachos that appear in the Gemara do not apply to modern-day Christians in the way, and this was very important in terms of dealing with the community in which he lived. Because remember, he's living in Provence, which is a strictly Christian country. Now, how this Meiri is dealt with in Halacha is a great question. Because remember, no one saw it. No one knew about this Shita for 500 years. And then it's introduced, it's a good question. But the idea that this is an important sheet of the Meiri to be aware of, is what I wanted to share. Okay, next we move to the Rush. Now the Rush, we mentioned before from Ramban, the Rush is really going to clinch the deal, because the Rush, he's born in 1250, dies in 1327. In 1303, he's living here in Germany as a student of Maharam in Rothenburg. He travels through France and settles first in Barcelona, and he becomes a kind of a confidant, a friend of Rashba, Rav Shlomo ben Aderet, the student of Ramban, and then ultimately he settles nearby for his own community. But now, you really have the first, in addition to Ramban, but now the first full integration in that you have a person, one great gong, one great rabbinic giant, who himself learned in Germany, and then in France, and actually is now learning in Spain. So this is the full integration of the Ashkenazi Sarfas tradition and the Sfarad tradition. And he has a son who's going to write an important work in Halacha called the Rush, the tour. So the Rush was, I mentioned before, he was a friend, I guess a colleague of the Rashba. He got him, so he was involved in the controversy. The Rambam's works generated a lot of controversy in Spain, where there were many Jews who were involved in studying secular topics, which we'll come back to in a little bit. He was involved in supporting the Rashba's ban. Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet put a ban on people from studying philosophy at a young age because he was worried that it was going to corrupt their views. So the Rush wrote a very important, he wrote Responsa, but he also wrote a very important commentary on the Gemara, which is the page that I have for you. Here, the Rush, it's actually more like a commentary on the Rif. Rav Yitzchak Alfasi, one of the earlier Spanish Rishonim who came before the Rambam, he truncated the study of Gemara into just the halachic pieces, and that you'll find in the end of a classic Vilna edition. Anything that's not practical, he doesn't quote it. So there's no commentary of Rif, Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, on sacrifices, on Kachim. There's nothing on Taros. And the same thing for the Rush. If it's not in the Rif, it's not going to be on the Rush. Rabbi Nirasha ben Yechiel, though, he is now going to synthesize in a halachic work everything from the Balei HaTosfos and from the Chachmei Sfarad. So this Rush is a very important one that you're looking in front of you, because it's the Rush about Cholent. There is a machlokes, a big machlokes, in the beginning of the third parak of Masechah Shabbos about maintaining hot food on Shabbos. How do you maintain hot food on Shabbos when the Gemara has a concern? In the old days, they had wood-burning stoves. They had coals. The concern was, maybe somebody's going to come and poke the coals, and they're going to try to aid the cooking process over Shabbos. This is machlokes in the Mishnah about how to paskin. What do you require to do? Do you have to take out the coals? Do you have to put a blech on? How cooked does your food have to be? Does it have to be partially cooked or fully cooked? Big machlokes, Rabbanan and Chananya. That's the debate. We don't have time to talk about it now. But here, this is the great line from the Rush. Ubishvil, because, in the underline, Sharabu Hadeos Bahai Piska, because there are many different opinions about this question. The Yisrael and the Jewish people, Adukim B'mitzvas Oneg Shabbos. They are so connected. They love Oneg Shabbos. They love Cholent. V'lo Yishmu L'Hachmir. And they won't listen to us if we try to paskin L'Hachmir like the Rabbanon. Hanach Lehen K'minag Shenogu Al Pi HaPoskim K'Chananya. You can be lenient to rely on Chananya when you make your cholent, as long as it's Machal Ben Drusoi, then you can blech it, and it's not going to be a problem. So you see, in those days already, there was some question about how to navigate Hilchos Shabbos, and he says, look, people love their cholent, don't be too machmir. Okay, last two people, last two great rabbinic figures from this piece. We're going to continue, this is going to be the last, we're going to talk about France and Germany for a long time, because in 1306, what happens to the Jews of France? Get out. They're all out. This is one of many expulsions that happens. So essentially what's happening here, Maharam in Wittenberg, he's living, and the one thing I wish Professor Halpern would have done was he would have spaced out Tsarfas and Ashkenaz a little more so you could see it. But by the year 1300, that is the end of great Jewish scholarship in France. That's it. There are no other great rabbinic academies. There are yeshivas, there were great rabbis who were in France over the centuries, but it wasn't a major center of Jewish learning until today. What's happening? Maharam Rothenberg has his students. Maharam Rothenberg has his students, Mordechai and Hagos Maimini, who are martyred, but they're all now living in Germany. Everybody has moved out from France, they're living in Germany, and everything is going to start to move. You see, this is going to be the migration of Jews from France. Rashi is the bedrock. They're going to be moving through the 14th century into Germany, and ultimately, a little later, they're going to be moving over to Poland. This map, which you can look at later, actually shows the development of both the migration from Ashkenazi communities and from Sephardic communities when they're being exiled and they're moving in different directions. So in Ashkenaz, they're going to be moving further and further east as we go along. But what happens to all the great traditions of the Ashkenazi communities as they keep moving? So this is where Maharil is crucial. That's where you have our next figure. That's Rav Yaakov Molin, who was a student of Rav Shalom of Neustadt. And Maharil is probably most famous from the piece, the work that you have in front of you. He was born around the year 1360. He was the rabbi of Jewish communities in Germany, Austria, and Bohemia. He was born in Mainz. He has very important works specifically about minhagim. What are minhagim? Customs. It's Maharil who codifies many of the minhagim that existed in the French and German communities. If we took a survey here, how many of us are Ashkenazi? Okay. We couldn't live without Maharil. Every time you see in the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, we'll talk about later, from Krakow, he says, oh, this is Ashkenazi minhag. Oh, 75, 80, 90%. It puts in parentheses, whoever edited it, Maharil. Marenu Harav Yaakov Molin. What did Maharil do? He collected all the important minhagim from the German and French communities, and he wrote them down. Here's an example of one on the page that you have in front of you. Kidneyos! If you were in Sfar, no one heard of this. But if you're in Ashkenaz, Maharil is crucial. Omar Maharash, who is Maharash Marino Harav, my teacher Rav Sholem of Neustadt. De Gazrin on Shalol Lavash Lama Pesach. This is one of, it's not the earliest, but one of the classic sources to disallow legumes, kidneys, on Pesach, because they're going to get confused with the five grains that create chametz on Pesach. And so many and so many and so many more. If you look through Shulchan Aruch, our practices, many of our minhagim, come from this sefer, Maharil of Minhagim. So there are many different kinds of svarim. We spoke about commentaries. We spoke about halachic codes like the Rambam. We spoke about responsa like Maharam in Rothenburg. But this is a different kind of literature. This is a different kind of Torah sefer. It's the sefer of Minhagim. And he writes at the end, it's not just that we had minhagim, it's that minhagim are important. And that somebody says, oh, he just wants to be makel because it's a minhag, yisacher pi dovrei sheker. It's ridiculous. Minhagim are important to the integrity of the halachic system, and therefore, you have to protect them and you have to observe them, and you can't just do away with them if you don't like them. And this is going to be something that's going to carry on for many generations. So this is Maharil, the sefer of minhagim. And the last in this segment is Rivosh. Rav Yitzchak ben Sheshes is going to talk to us a little bit from his responsa. He was born in Barcelona. Where he was an unofficial rabbi until about 1370, when he was arrested on false charges. At this point, already by the 14th century, there's a full reconquest of the Iberian Peninsula by the Christians. So he's living in this area of Barcelona, which is already going to be Christian anyway, and he's going to suffer a lot through his life. In 1391, this was a time of tremendous anti-Jewish persecution all through the Iberian Peninsula, and at that time, he was in Valencia. According to one opinion, and it's hard to even say what this means, I don't know what this means, according to one opinion in the Encyclopedia Judaica, and everything that I'm sharing with you today is either research-based, and I have tremendous hakar satov to Kayla Eisenbach from our office, who helped me with a lot of the printings and pieces together. Everything is academically sound, except for the pictures. The pictures on these covers. I have no idea. These are, you know, like you Google these pictures, they could be Kayla Eisenbach's great-great-grandfather, or they could be some shopkeeper from Tzfat. I don't know. We just brought them because that's what you find on Google. But everything else is really sound. So according to one opinion in Encyclopedia Judaica, Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshes Perfet, was actually baptized. The chief rabbi of the community was baptized in 1391, and he lived as a Murano for a year and a half until he escaped to North Africa. So now, there are different views on whether or not that account is accurate, but it just speaks to the intensity of the persecution against Jews in the 14th century. This is now the time when Jews are converting, becoming Muranos, and the Inquisition is really strong, trying to root out what they called new Christians. So he arrives in Algiers. So this is his journey. He's going to leave from Spain. He's going to head through North Africa and the Mediterranean. He's going to end up in Algiers. And he writes a very interesting tshuva. He writes a responsa, which is what you have in front of you. On the right-hand column, I put in numbers so we can follow. On the left-hand is letters. Ma shesha'alta mimeni, you asked me a question. Ma hi chachma yevonis. What is Greek wisdom? Asher yisrachi ka'adam. Someone asked the question of the Rivash. The Gemara says that it's prohibited to study Chachma Yevonis. How do you translate Chachma Yevonis? Greek wisdom. There is an absolute prohibition against studying Greek wisdom in the Talmud. So this questioner wants to know, what does that mean? Ha'im heim osam svarim hamufursamim ba'olam kishema tiv'i masha achar hateva. Are they works of natural sciences? Are we allowed to have these books in our libraries? Are we allowed to study them? Keep in mind, where is he coming from? He's coming from Spain, where many studied philosophy and the natural sciences, as opposed to, as many observe, as opposed to an Ashkenaz, where they weren't as engaged in secular culture. Here was very knowledgeable. Aye, but it says Beferish in the Gemara, you're not allowed to study Chachma Yevonis. So he quotes the Gemara where it is raised, and that's the story on line number 4, and on the second column, line D, V'lachein Yerali, he says, I'll tell you what I think. This is the study of the Talmud, because everything comes back to the Gemara. The Rambam says, no one can argue with the Gemara. The Gemara is the conclusion of Torah Shebaal Peh in its coalesced form, because that's when all the sages of the rabbinic community were together. After that, people are dispersed in all different places. So you have different minhagim, but the Gemara is everything. So what does the Gemara mean? E, D and E. Chachma Yevonis hi ladaber b'loshon Yevoni is to speak in Greek, bechidos, in riddles, u'b'loshon sasum, shelo yavino oso hahamon. It's a secret code language. When it says in the Gemara that you're not allowed to use Chachma Yevonis, it's referring to a special kind of code, speech, a secret speaking code that they used to use that the general populace did not understand. Therefore, says Rivash, there's nothing wrong with studying, technically, there's nothing wrong with studying philosophy or general natural sciences. But go to the next page. On line 30, he says, okay, he quotes Rashi's opinion, then he goes on, and he says, Omnam, Sifra Teva Mufur Samim Loman Hashem, who said, the natural sciences are not included in this restriction. Aval, he says, Roy Limona Mehem, you should refrain from studying them. If they are trying, if they are aiming to uproot the main institutions of Jewish thought, of our sanctity, the sanctity of our Torah. Ubefrat, specifically, imheim, what are they? Amudei HaTavach, Shnei Amudei HaTavach, the basis of our religion, asher hinachonu aleim, that it rests on them. Shezeu, what's that? Number one, Chidush HaOlam. Be careful if you study Aristotelian philosophy, because you have to remember, we believe in Chidush HaOlam, ex nihilo creation. God created the world. And V'hashkochas Hashem Yisbarach Befirtei Hamin HaEnoshi, and divine providence. Be careful if you get too involved in psychology or in philosophy, you might get carried away and lose your belief in these basic tenets of Jewish faith. So this is going to be very important in navigating how do we deal with studying different aspects of general studies. We have to be careful. On the one hand, it's permitted to make inroads into those secular knowledge. But on the other hand, we have to be careful not to let it undo the basic yesodos of our religion. Ad Kan, section 2. Let's take a 2-minute break. And then we'll reconvene. Pause. Okay, we're now in the green packets, part 3, 14:15 till 16:15. We begin with Don Yitzchak Abarbanel, Rav Yitzchak Abarbanel,
who was born to and raised in one of the most prominent families, prominent Jewish families from a cultural standpoint in all of the Iberian Peninsula. He spent 45 years in Portugal. His father was extremely involved in the aristocracy, and the king had Alfonso V. He was a leading financier, and Abarbanel himself was. He had a very, very vast personal fortune. However, when Alfonso died, and his son, who was taking over, there was a bit of a coup that was instigated by some other members of the family, and the son suspected Abarbanel of participating in this coup. And so Abarbanel had to flee from Lisbon, from Portugal, in 1483, and he resettles in Spain, where he was able to actually transfer much of his wealth. However, that level of success is not going to be so long-lived. In 1485, he's sentenced to death in absentia in Portugal, but he becomes one of the senior statesmen in the Spanish kingdom. The king was
Ferdinand
and Isabella. In 1492,
he arranged the marriage.
So in 1492, that I don't know. In 1492, however, in the spring, the Jews are now expelled. And despite many efforts by Abarbanel, they were not successful in annulling the decree. So Abarbanel himself goes into exile with many Jews. He arrives in Italy, and he travels along the Italian coast in different places, and that's where he writes his massive Pirush on Tanakh, which is amazing for people like me who have ants in their pants. So it's very difficult to learn Abarbanel because he is so lengthy, has so many questions, so complex. Sometimes you can get lost a little bit, but it's really it's a tremendous commentary, and that's what you have, the piece which is in front of you. And Abarbanel, in his commentary in several places, actually integrates his experience of his life in explaining various passages in Tanakh, which is really quite fascinating. And what you have in front of you is a piece from the Abarbanel on the Tochacha. What's the Tochacha? It's the section of curses in this part, in the Parshas Kisav, on the end of Sefer Devarim. And he describes Vahefsara Shishi, the sixth calamity that's going to happen to us, is what it says in the Pasuk, Va'avaratim Shom Elohim Achirim Ashelo Yadata Atav Vavosecha Eitz Va'oven. We're going to be exiled, and we're going to worship other gods. Says Abarbanel, Ve'ena Kavona, I'm on the third line, I put the little arrow in front of the paragraph. Ve'ena Kavona B'zeh, it's not to be said, Hama'amar, in this comment, She'yavdu Lo'ovdeim, Kamosha Pirish Rashi. Rashi says, what's going to happen to us, it means we are going to be subject to those who worship idols. We're going to have to serve those who worship idols. Says Abarbanel, no, that's not what's going to happen. Ela inyano, sha'achari bo'am begolos. After we go into exile, yeitzu rabim mechlal hadas mitoch hatzoros v'hagzeru shalu yuchlo l'sovlam. We're going to suffer, and what's going to happen to us? Yeitzu min hadas. We're going to leave the religion. What is Abarbanel reflecting on? The fact that hundreds of thousands of Jews chose to be baptized rather than leave in the exile, rather than stay with their Judaism. Many of them became Aranos, but some of them became converted. So Abarbanel says this is what the Tochacha is talking about. This Tochacha is the second destruction, it's the second Golos. So it's referring to the Golos that we're in right now. And he says people are going to leave. And they become Christians. Amazing Pirush, right? Fascinating. But that's only half the story. That's only half of what's incredible here. Because Abarbanel's commentary, which we have three different versions of, Abarbanel's commentary was censored by the Christian censors. So thanks to an incredible scholar by the name of Rabbi Dr. Schneer Lyman, who actually got a hold of an original manuscript of Abarbanel before it was touched up by the censors, this passage is even more powerful. And you have on your page the piece from Dr. Lyman from the censored, the uncensored version on the next half of the page. If you notice, you see, wait, I put the little 30.
These are the selections of this piece of Abarbanel that were taken out by the censor. And what does it say? In our version, right here at the end of the paragraph, it concludes, V'chol osa ha-parsha. That is the whole parsha, meaning they quote from the Navi Yechezkel. The Yechezkel says that people are going to think they can run away from God, and God says, no, b'chem ha-shfucha emloch aleichem, I will always rule over you. That's the end. That's all we have in the printed edition. This is the Yerushalayim, one of the three classic editions of Abarbanel. But look in the next page, where I put the arrow in section 30. On the third piece here, third paragraph, this is from Dr. Lyman's article, Abarbanel and the Censor. It starts with the words, V'chol Osa HaParsha. You see where it says in the bracket, V'chol Osa HaParsha? Where I put the arrow three paragraphs in. That's the end of what we have in the printed version. Now Abarbanel says, let me tell you what I mean. Rotza Lomar. Sha'af api she'yis'arvu bagoyim. Even though Jews will become conversos. V'yilmadu mimaseim v'yavdu es Elohim. And they will worship Christian gods. Lo yieh lahem margoa umanoach. They won't have any respite. Ki tomid yecharfu hagoyim osam hayosim mechlal adas. The Gentiles will always denigrate them. V'yachshivu aleim alilos. And what are they going to do? They're going to suspect them and call them out. What's that? Mipa'as dosam v'yachashdum. And they will consider them. Tomid jemisyadim. They're going to say, oh, you're really secretly crypto-Jews. And what's going to happen? Sha'al yedei ze'eh al ze'eh yigalgu l'aleim sakonos atzumos. They're going to create terrible dangers. There's one word for this. It's called? Inquisition. What was the job of the Inquisition? It was to find out crypto-Jews who had converted to Christianity. And says Abarbanel, Uma gam ata bizmaneinu ze'eh la'yehudim. What happens to us? Shame ovdim as Elohim zekarv legimel meoshana. For 300 years, Jews have converted in Spain, and yet the Inquisition is still chasing them. Yedaktiku imam v'yachashum leYehudim gemurim v'yisrafum ba'esh kasher asu b'chol malchus svarad. That's going to be in all the print in all of the kingdom of Spain. And this was taken out by the censor because it's deliberately describing the Inquisition. Amazing. So this is the Pirush HaAbarbanel of how it understands God's prophecy of destruction in Sefer Devarim. This was written, I don't know exactly, so it's going to be sometime, he died in 1508, so sometime around the year 1500. But now I wanted to share with you one figure from Italian Jewry, and that's Sforno, Rav Ovadia Sforno. He's born in 1478, dies in 1550. So there were many great chachamim who are living in Italy. It happens to be that the Mahari Cologne and the Ramchal, many other great Italian commentaries. You'll see, we're now moving in this chart. We finished this chart. This ends in 1492. We're now in 1490 on the bottom here. You see in... where are we? Here. Abarbanel is making his way. This is Italy. This is Ashkenaz, Poland, Turkey, North Africa, Egypt, and Israel. What two major regions are missing from this chart? France and Spain. Because there's nothing after this. There's no Spain and there's no France. Because Spain, all the Jews are gone in 1492. And all the Jews are out of France. So now you can see how the migration affects the learning. Everything is now moved. Abarbanel started here, moved here, ends up here. And now you have a significant community. Sforno, he's actually studying mathematics and philosophy and medicine in Rome. One of the local bishops, I'll tell you his name. His name was... Cardinal Grimani.
He was an acquaintance of Rav Ovadia Sforno, who convinced Rav Ovadia Sforno to teach the Christian humanist Johann Reuchlin, who was also some important Italian figure, to teach him Hebrew.
This is all going on in Italy in the 15th century, and there's a great amount of openness between the Jewish community in Italy and the others at that time. Now, Italy becomes going to be very important for another reason. The northern edge of Italy, there's a small town called Livorno. Livorno is going to be important because it becomes a major publishing hub. What happens in 1450? 1450, the Gutenberg Bible. Now all of a sudden, the printing press is introduced in Europe, and specifically in northern Italy, many, many Sfarim are going to be published during this, especially the incunabular period, the initial period of publishing Sfarim, and then beyond. So Italy is going to be very important. So the Sforno is living in Rome, and then ultimately he settles in Bologna, and he writes a commentary on the Chumash, which you have here, the Hakdamah to Sefer Bereishis. And Rav Ovadia Sforno, full disclosure, the English translation of the Sforno is authored by our family member, Rabbi Rafal Pelkovitz, so just so there shouldn't be anybody think it's anything funny business over here. So the Sforno wrote a commentary, wrote a philosophical work. He also wrote a commentary on the Chumash and many of the books in Tanakh. So this introduction, this is the Sforno's introduction to Sefer Bereishis, which is actually a very important work in terms of understanding what does it mean to be the chosen people. People say we're racist, we hate other people, we think we're better than other people, because we say that we're chosen. Well, what does it mean to be chosen? So Rav Ovadia Sforno develops the idea. It's the model, the baseball, three strikes and you're out model. And this is very important in terms of understanding chosenness in our interactions with others. The Sforno begins, is what? It's line 5. V'siper harish rishona ki hu yizbarach bara ha'adam b'tzalmo kedmusmo l'man yivchar lihidamos liyotzro kafi ha'efshar. God created human beings so that we could be godly, that we could perfect the world like the Rabbono Shel Olam. Our job is to be godly, is to do good. The same way the Rabbono Shel Olam does good, we should do good. Build the world, don't tear it down. That's our job. Who's our? When I say the word our, who's our? Everyone. Anyone is created by God. All of humanity. So according to Sforno, the reason the Rabbono Shel Olam created the world is so that all human beings can serve God, can bring godliness into the world. That was the purpose. Period. The problem is that it didn't quite work out. And the Sforno says, look, this is the three strikes and you're out policy. God says, okay, I'm going to create a little experiment. I'm going to put you guys into a little space. When I was growing up, we used to have these little men, these little people like Fisher-Price, the Menchies, right? So Rabbono Shel Olam said, we're going to have a little practice. I don't know if they're popular anymore because people think they're a choking hazard, all the crazy problems of modernity. So in the old days, we had a little Menchies and you had a little play area. So kivyachol, so to speak, God says, I'm perfect. And I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to remove the Ein Sof, godliness, from a little space. I'm going to put a lot of menshilach in here. And you guys try to create godliness in this space. That's what we're all doing. That's what we're here doing right now. Bringing godliness into the world. So God says, okay, go for it. So he puts the first two people in there. They have their own kids. And what happens? One kid kills the other kid. God says, oh, people are killing each other. All right. One mistake. We're not going to throw the whole experiment out from one mistake. So, okay. Let's try it again. Let's recreate everything. We'll come up with Shais. We'll have lots of people populating the world. What happens in the end of the story and beginning of Parshas Bereishis? The flood. Why is the flood? Because everybody's corrupt. The men are grabbing the women. They're stealing. It's horrible. So God says, this is really bad. You know, we're all trying to bring godliness and benevolence into the world, and you're totally corrupt. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to take all the little menshilach. We're going to wipe them off the little play area. We're going to start again. We'll try it one more time. Okay. We take them out of the ark. After a couple of generations, what do we have? We have the story of the Migdal Bavel. The Migdal Bavel is the story of failed civilization. Everybody has to speak the same language. There's many different interpretations of Migdal Bavel. Either it's on one extreme, like Chazal say, that it was actually trying to fight God and create idolatry, an idolatrous civilization, or the Netziv, Rav Natali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, in the Hamikdavar, he says it was the first, fascinating, it was the first tyrannical regime. It was the first despot. Nimrod says everybody has to be Safa Achas, one language, and we're going to build a Migdal so that I can see, I can spy on everyone. It's going to be like a search tower. Either way, society is totally fallen apart. So who appears immediately after the Migdal Bavel in Parshas Noach? Right, Avram Avinu. Because the Kodesh Baruch Hu says, look, three strikes and you're out. We tried to do an experiment where all of humanity will be given the mandate of bringing godliness into the world. Everybody will do that together. But you know what? It's not working. So you know what? Let's do this. Let's pick one guy, one family, one nation, one community. They'll be the ones whose job it is to help everybody else bring godliness into the world. Because it's not going to work just me and everybody, God says. I'm going to pick one family to work as my partners. That, says the Sfarno, is the story of Sefer Bereishis, and that is the story of Jewish chosenness. It's not that we're better than everybody else. It's not that we think, okay, let everybody else drop dead because only matters what we do. No, our job is to live in such a manner that we bring godliness into the world and we inspire everybody else to bring godliness into the world. We're in it together with them. You're not supposed to kick them down. This is the beautiful introduction that the Sfarno has to Sefer Bereishis. Okay. We're still here in the 15th century, and we move to one of the most important halachic codifiers in Jewish history, and that is Rav Yosef Karo. Rav Yosef Karo was born in 1488 in Spain, probably in Toledo, in Castile. So he's born up here. But what happens? 1488? So then 3 years later, 3.5 years later, in 1492, he's expelled. So he has to travel. He's moving along the Mediterranean Sea, settles in Turkey, and then, after a period of time in Turkey, he moves south and stops in Tzfat. He settles in Tzfat in the 16th century, which is at that point becoming a place of Torah learning. For hundreds of years, Ramban, when he got to Yerushalayim, he describes how it was came out of wasteland. They couldn't barely get a minyan. But now you'll see this is Eretz Yisrael. When Rav Yosef Karo arrives in Israel, you start to see there's quite a bit of activity here in the scholarship going on in Israel. That's going to continue for a little bit of time. He has a teacher in Tzfat. His name is Mahari Bey Rav. And Rav Yosef Karo is involved in several very important decisions of that time. One of them was the question about smicha. The Mahari Bey Rav, Rabbi Yaakov Bey Rav, who was the chief rabbi of Tzfat at the time, based on the Rambam, decided he was going to reintroduce the concept of smicha. What is smicha? Right, rabbinical decrees, ordination. I don't have smicha. I have a letter of smicha. It's signed by Rabbi Lam and Rabbi Chalap and Rav Schechter. But it's not real smicha. Real smicha is ish mi pi ish mi Moshe Rabbeinu. One person to the next from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. That's real authentic smicha. This is kind of like an artificial smicha just so that I can get a job. You know, otherwise, I'll just, whatever. But it's not real. It's not real bona fide smicha. So in the 15th century, 16th century, the Mahari Bey Rav decided, what if we got all the sages of Israel together? We could reinstitute, honest to goodness, real old-fashioned smicha. So they tried to do this in Tzfat. Then they sent a letter to Yerushalayim, to the Maharal Bach, Rav Levi Ibn Chabiv, who said, no dice. And that created a huge controversy. But Rav Yosef Karo was one of the first people who got actual smicha, ish mi piish, from the Mahari Bey Rav in Tzfat. So this was just one interesting thing. Happens to be, we mentioned before, Rivash, the tshuva of the Rivash. Rivash has probably the seminal tshuva about modern-day smicha. What does it mean that I have a letter that says I have smicha? So the Rivash has a tshuva about what that means. Rav Yosef Karo was also involved in another important debate with Rabbi, a tremendous Talmud Chacham, the Ma'abit, Rav Moshe of Trani, who was also living in Tzfat, about the following question. Let's say you have land in the land of Israel, and it's Shemitah year. Okay. And that land is owned by non-Jews. Do the fruit that grows in that land, do they have the sanctity of Shemitah or not? Ma'abit said, yes, they do. And Rav Yosef Karo, in the Tshuvas, in the Avkas Rochel, he says, no, they do not.
And because we paskan like the Avkas Rochel, therefore there is a basis for what we call today Heter Mechira. Because if we didn't have that pas, if we didn't have the psak of the Avkas Rochel regarding selling the land, it wouldn't help to do Heter Mechira today, to sell the land to non-Jews in Israel, to allow some kind of working arrangement of the farms during Shemitah, because it wouldn't help. Even if you sold the land, it would still be subject to the laws of Shemitah. It's because of Yosef Kara's Psak and Avkas Rochel that we're allowed to do the Heter Mechira today. Okay, but the main thing Rav Yosef Kara wrote, the most important sefer he wrote was called Beis Yosef, not the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch was basically the kid's version of the Beis Yosef. Like, the big leagues is the Beis Yosef. T-ball is the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the Beis Yosef is a very extensive commentary on the Tur. The Tur was the son of the Rush who wrote a four-section halachic compendium. First one is called Orachayim, Daily Living. Yoredeya, Mitzvos, Isser Veheter, Allowed and Not Allowed. Choshen Mishpat, Civil, and Evan Ezer, Marital Law. Those are the four sections. The problem with the Tur, Beis Yosef says, wait a second. It doesn't give you any sources. It gives you very little. It doesn't give you, the development. It just kind of tells you A, B, C, D. It's very terse. What we need is we need to really develop the ideas based on the different Rishonim. So he writes what's called the Beis Yosef, the House of Yosef, which is his commentary, running commentary on all four sections of the Torah. It is an incredible work. And then the question becomes, how do you paskin? How do you rule? How do we follow? Because remember, Beis Yosef, he is right here at the end of the Spanish tradition, so he knows everything that came before him. Beis Yosef knows all of the the Torah of Marami Rutenberg and Rabbi Tam and Rashi, but he also knows Rosh and Ramban and Rambam. He's got it all, and he's trying to sort it out for us. How do you paskin? So he says in his introduction to Beis Yosef, this is what we're going to do. There is a halacha, it says, Achari Rabim Lahatos. A rabbinic court rules based on majority. So what we're going to do is we're going to take the three most important rabbinic figures in the world of Psak, and we're going to follow the majority. Who are they? Look in the underline of the piece that you have in the Hakdama to the Beis Yosef. He writes, who are the three Amudei Haorah? They are Halohema, Harif, Vaharambam, Vaharosh. The Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh. And when the two of them agree to one aspect, we're going to follow that opinion, unless there is the minug, the consensus is otherwise. How's that going to work out for us? Wait a second. Let's look on the map for a second. Wait a minute. Okay, the Rif is down here, right here. He is Sfardi. He predated the Rambam. One. Two, the Rambam, squarely Sfarad. And three is the Rush, who spent part of his time in Ashkenaz, part of his time in Sfarad. So now you can see where this is going. If you're Sephardic, you are Sephardic for a reason. Because the deck is stacked. He says we're going to take two out of three. Well, almost inevitably, you're almost always going to follow, if you follow Beis Yosef, you're almost always going to follow the Sephardic Rishonim. Because two out of three are always from Sfarad. They never had any access to the Torah of Ashkenaz. So then it becomes a huge pushback in other areas of the world. Where might that be? It's going to be right over here. Because through the 15th century, things continued to move eastward into Germany, the Chavis Yar, Rav Yar Bachrach, and others, and then into Poland. You're looking at this map. By the time the 17th century rolls around, this whole area, which is, you see, Prussia, Silesia, Habsburg, Russia, Bologna, Muscovite, Lithuania. This is all hugely populated with Jewish communities. Now, there were Jewish communities in this area in Poland. Jaffa Eliach, who is a tremendous Holocaust scholar, her family is from a small shtetl called Eisenach. She documents in her massive work, There Once Was a World, her shtetl dates back almost 900 years in Poland. But it wasn't a major site of Jewish learning and Jewish living until the migration moves eastward. But look at how big this area is. You're talking about Lithuania, Latvia, Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia. All of this is Jewish communities.
Where are they coming from? They're coming from the German communities that are migrating through, not having anything to do with what's going on. They had access, they had knowledge, but their minhagim were based on Maharil. They knew what was going on in Italy with Maharik and with Sforno, and they knew what was going on with Rav Ovadia Sforno. They knew what was going on with Rav Yosef Karo in Turkey and in Sfat, because the scholarship made its way, especially now that you're in the 1600s and some books are being printed. But their minhagim are really based on Ashkenaz. So comes Rav Moshe Isserlis, the next figure in our series, and he says, wait a minute, Shulchan Aruch. That's very good if you want to always paskin like the Sfarim. What about us? What about Mordechai? What about Hagos Maimoni? What about Maharani Ruthenberg? What about Rabbi Nutam and the Ri and the Wali Toslos? Come on, man. That's where we're coming from. So therefore, Rama writes Galasis to the Shulchan Aruch, and that's what you see on the next page. He's born in 1530, and he dies in 1572, which is pretty amazing that he only lived 42 years. And this is an incredible story. This story speaks about a tshuva, which I have here, I'm holding for you. It's an incredible tshuva, it's an amazing story. And it itself shows the power of psak and the importance of of knowing the Rishonim and the development of the Mesorah. The tshuva of the Ramah, which is 125 that you don't have in front of you, is going to be codified in your page here, which is the glosses on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch rules in the underline, V'lo Mekadshin. You may not marry on Shabbos. This is in Simon Shin Lamites, Sif Dalet. The Shulchan Aruch is the kids' version of the Beis Yosef. It's the condensed version of the four books, just succinct, bottom line. You're not allowed to get married on Shabbos. But the tshuva discusses the following story. Ramo writes in a tshuva in a response where he says, I hear people are talking about me behind my back. People are complaining. Look at what Moshe does. Habitu acharei Moshe. Because he officiated at a wedding on Shabbos. What's going on? In those days in Europe, it was very common for people to get married on Friday afternoon. Why? Because they couldn't afford to have chicken during the week, and then again on Shabbos, they couldn't afford it. It was interesting. I was getting my haircut on Friday at Benny the Barber, Sheyichya, on California. So he's telling. I always try to go there to ask him. He's living me well. He has numbers on his arm because he wasn't just a barber in Chicago. He was a barber in Auschwitz. So I was asking about when he was growing up. So he tells me on Friday, he says, well, they had 9 kids living in 2 rooms, his parents and 9 kids. And he said, you know, he was a barber in their town, which is where Ben-Gurion grew up. And he says, you know, we had fruits and vegetables because there were a lot of farmers. But he said, who had eggs? We couldn't afford eggs. And he says, now you get eggs. It's so cheap. He said, we didn't have eggs. Didn't have eggs. So we ate eggs, I forget, he said, maybe Pesach or something. So they never had eggs on a regular basis in their house. Forget chicken, they didn't even have eggs. So they made weddings on Friday. What happens if you have 2 incorrigible fathers who are haggling about a dowry? So here you have Nebuch, a couple that's sitting around. The girl wants to get married, the boy wants to get married, but they can't get married because the fathers are fighting in the back room about the money. Meanwhile, it's starting to get late, and the Ramah is discussing a case where it was a broken situation, Nebuch the parents, and this and that, and they didn't have the money, and the husband was going to walk. It was going to be a terrible busha. So says Ramah in his glasses on Shulchan Aruch, he didn't make it up his own, V'yesh matirin l'kadesh, and there is a lenient opinion, one minority opinion, to proceed with the marriage on Shabbos, hecha de'in lo isha ubanim, where they have no children, v'efshar, and possibly duhu adin kenisa l'chuppah, shari, it's even mutter to get a chuppah, v'afagav de lo kaimalachi, even though the mainstream psak doesn't follow that, mikol makom nonetheless, somchim al zeh b'shas hadchak. In a case of need, in a desperate situation, since there is a legitimate opinion, and where is it coming from? The Chachmei HaTzarfas, from the Tosfos, it's going to be permitted. Ki gadol kavod habrios, because of kavod habrios. What is kavod habrios? Personal dignity. What a shame it's going to be for this girl to have to walk away from the wedding because she can't get married, because her parents are fighting with the in-laws because they don't have money.
What's going to happen? Kemosha regilin shalafim lo hayu yicholim lahashvasim and adunya biyom vav aralayla to osan achukba vakidushin b'leil Shabbos. They're going to make the wedding anyway, even though you're not supposed to generally. Why? They already made the whole wedding. Everyone's sitting around. Can you imagine what an embarrassment if they tell everybody, you know what? Go home. Wedding's off. People are there. They're sitting there. And therefore, he says, you should be careful not to come to that. But b'dieved, you can rely on the minority opinion, which they quote here in the parentheses, comes from the Smag and from the Rabbeinu Tam. So this is Rabbeinu Tam and the Baalei HaTosfos. Their tradition lives on in the halachic works, in the Ashkenazi tradition, through the Ramah and its commentary, his glosses on the Shulchan Aruch. The last in this segment is the Maharal, which is what you have in front of you here.
No picture.
No picture, yeah. We couldn't find any picture of Maharal. Maharal introduces us to a new dimension of Torah, a new way of looking at the Agadata. Until now, we've spoken so much about Halacha, but the Maharal, who himself was a great Talmudist, a great mathematician, he was from a great family, he came from Worms. For a while, he was a rabbi in Moravia, but most eventually he settled back in Prague in 1592. He met with the emperor. He was known for his piety. He was regarded highly even by the non-Jews. There was a famous philosopher at the time, the astronomer Tycho Brahe, who the Maharal had some interactions with. And the Maharal revolutionized the study of the Agadata, the parts of the Gemara that are non-halachic. These are very important in terms of teaching. Rashi used them as medrash, as a basis, and sometimes they're often misunderstood. Imagine last year, they commemorated the centennial, the beginning of World War I. So imagine you opened up a container, like a time capsule from World War I, you opened up a newspaper, and it said in the newspaper, 10,000 men drown in a drop of ink. That was the newspaper. 10,000 men, French newspaper, 10,000 men drown in a drop of ink. So what would you say about that newspaper? So you might say, wow, they had a very big drop of ink, or they were very foolish, or if you're wise, you'll say, oh, they must be speaking allegorically. You know what they must mean? That when the King of France signed the Declaration of War by putting his quill into a drop of ink, that immediately, that first day, caused the death of 10,000 men. But in a literary device, they're using the expression 10,000 men drowned in a drop of ink. It doesn't mean that actually that's what they said. Very often, today, people don't appreciate the Agadata, the homiletic sections of the Gemara or the Midrash, and they say, oh, it's just like silly Aesop's fables, it's just silly stories. But it's not. The only people who are silly who say that, the people are silly, not the Midrash is silly. The Midrash is trying to teach you deep lessons, and they share it oftentimes in code. The same way that you could convey that 10,000 people died the first day of World War I in a drop of ink. So Maharal transforms our understanding of Agadata. And I share with you just one piece here, because this shir was originally given on Shavuos. We shared one piece of Maharal on Matan Torah. The Gemara says that when we came to Har Sinai, God put the mountain over our head like a barrel. And he said, it's a very Chicago-style way of life, he says, take the Torah or don't take it. If you don't take it, you'll die. That's old, that's real Chicago, right? That's how they do it around here. So Maharal says, what do you mean? First of all, Tosa says, they said, Nasa v'nishma, how could that be? So Maharal says a very important point. He says, you know why? He says, it's because it's not that we didn't want to take the Torah. We did want to take the Torah. But imagine one day we said, you know what? We took the Torah then because we wanted it. Today, we don't want it anymore. We change our mind. We had to accept the Torah in a coercive manner to teach us a lesson. And that is that Torah is indispensable for the existence of life. If we accepted the Torah just because we wanted it, so then we might think that the Torah is here only because we chose it. Maharal says, we have to understand, and this is what's on your page, if you go down to line 23, Shelo Yomer Yisrael, that the Jewish people should not say, Anachnu kibalnu haTorah me'atzmeinu, we took it for ourselves. Vim lo ayinu rotzim, lo ayinu mekabel haTorah, we didn't have to take it. No, says Maharal, we have to understand, V'davar zeh, line 25, lo hayamalas haTorah, ki haTorah kol haolam taliba. We have to understand that the entirety of Torah is the underpinning of the world. If there was no Torah, there would not be any existence. And for that reason, we had to be coerced into taking it. Not that we didn't want to take it. We did want to take it. But we had to learn the lesson that it wasn't for us because we wanted to take it. It was because we had to have it in the world. It's good that we took it. We have to want to do it. But that's why we needed to receive it in a coercive manner. Part four. Two parts to go. We're now in the salmon-colored packet. Reb Shabtai Cohen. Oh, thank you. The Shach, 1621. So this is really, this is a man who's living 41 years, and he accomplishes so much in his knowledge and his scholarship and his contribution. The Shach, he was born in Lithuania, and if we had more time, we could develop what's happening between 1621 and 1662 in Lithuania, in Poland, and Ukraine. That's right, Khmelnytsky massacres. And this is true for many of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. They were affected personally and their families by the Khmelnytsky massacres because the commentaries that we have on Shulchan Aruch are primarily Ashkenazi commentaries from these areas. So the Shach, Rabbi Shabtai Cohen, first he's here in Lithuania, then he's going to make his way down to Lublin, and then he's going to have to run away from Lublin. But these are all Jewish communities that are going to be decimated in 1648 by the Khmelnytsky massacres. After the Khmelnytsky massacres, they're all going to be, incredibly, they're going to be unified under an autonomous Jewish government called the Council of the Four Lands, the Vat Arba Aratzos. So this is the borders of the Vat Arba Aratzos from 1667 till 1764. So the Shach is running on the run, but he's a tremendous genius. And he adds his commentary on Yoredeya, on the second chelik of Shulchan Aruch, the second section of Shulchan Aruch, and then after he dies, also it's published on Choshen Mishpat. He went back and forth with an older contemporary of his, the Taz, Rav David Halevi, in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch, and they fought back and forth in some different publications. But here's an example of where the Shach comes. He's like a steamroll. You can't stop the Shach. He's giant. And the world of halacha is huge. So the Ramah, Ramosha Isalis, on the commentary that you have right in front of you on the salmon-colored page, he comments on the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch is in the bold, and then in the middle, where the underline is, it's the comments of the Ramah, the glosses of Ramosha Isalis. So the Ramah writes, what happens when you have two pots and something gets mixed in? I'm making my cholent, and something gets mixed into the cholent that's going to cause it, render it non-kosher. So it depends how much of the non-kosher substance was mixed in, and what was the non-kosher substance. Is it what we call min bamino, the same substance? If that's the case, then it's going to be rove. The majority is going to determine whether it's kosher or not. So if I have a cholent with 20 pieces of meat and one piece of non-kosher meat falls in, it's going to be rove. But if it's min b'she'eino mino, it's another kind, then I require shishim, 60, to remove the tam. How do you decide what is the same and what is different? What's min b'mino and what's min b'she'eino mino? So the Ramah, on the next side of the page, says, I'm sorry, on this, in the underline here in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah says, ule inyan min b'mino azlinon basar shema. We go by the name. So if you have turkey and chicken falls in, it's different names. You need 60. And the Shach says, I do not agree with that. A gigantic long Shach, you see on the bottom where I put the wide lines, he says, no. And you see this giant Shach where he brings tons and tons of proofs. He's like a steamroller to prove that min bimino, the question doesn't depend on what it's called, chicken versus turkey. It depends on the ta'am, the taste. And that is how we paskin, Allah Chalamaisa. So this is a very important commentary on Shulchan Aruch, the Shach, and he marshals all these incredible sources. He himself had very much, he was kind of nomadic, he moved from place to place, but he used to go study wherever he was, and he essentially memorized all the tremendous texts that he had. And he became one of the great giants of Lithuanian Jewry. I wish we had more time, but we're going to have to move on to another figure who plays a huge role in the development of the life of Torah Judaism, and that is the Baal Shem. The Baal Shem Tov is born in 1698 in Ukraine, and he's on the backdrop of some very significant trends, three in particular. The first is, we spoke about the destruction of many Eastern European communities in the Khmelnytsky massacres, and then the pursuant ones, 1655 as well. These also in the backdrop of Jewish communities that are incredibly impoverished, impoverished and having a very difficult time financially. And then the third is that just a few years before, Shabtai Tzvi is exposed as a false messiah. And this left the spiritual state of the Jewish community in many parts of the world in ruins. So you have this tremendous vacuum, and on top of that, Jewish education and high level of learning was generally reserved for the intellectual and the Torah elite. So the masses were largely ignorant. So put all this together, and you have a certain malcontent in many segments of the Jewish peasant population. So comes the holy Baal Shem, and as a young child, he's orphaned, so he spends a lot of his time communing with God, because he has no actual parents. By his early teens, and there's a beautiful essay that we're working off of from Rav Aryeh Kaplan called The Hasidic Masters, where we'll quote from in a minute. But the Baal Shem Tov, at the age of a teenager, he already has the mastery of the Shulchan Aruch and the codes, but he's kind of a nister. People don't know him. He's hired as like a school monitor or a shamus. So he spends a lot of time in the forest with what we would call later hispodidus. Hispodidus is seclusion, just being alone with God. And God becomes really a part, an actual part of his life. And then on Lag BaOmer, in 17, I'll tell you the year, I think it was 1734. Yes, 1734, he reveals himself as a teacher and a master and a healer. He's known as the Baal Shem Tov, the man of the good name. And the Baal Shem was like a miracle worker and a spiritual leader, and people flocked him from all over. His primary pupil, his primary student, who recorded much of his teachings, because Baal Shem Tov wrote basically nothing, was Rav Yaakov Yosef of Polonia, as well as the Magid of Mezrich, Rav Dov Ber, the Mezricher Magid, whose students included the foundering of the Lubavitch movement, Rav Alter Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and many other great Hasidic masters. And then essentially it explodes to, it's a revolution. There's nothing else you could say. All over Eastern Europe, so you're talking all the way from Lithuania, there were Belarus, Ukraine, Romania, Hungary, Slovakia, all throughout Poland. This area over the next 150 years is going to be dominated by the rise of Hasidism, of a movement which, according to the way some describe it, the Arizal brought the secrets of Torah, the mystical tradition of Torah, the Kabbalah, out into the open. But he did that by taking the people and raising them to the heavens. The Baal Shem Tov took the heavens, the mystical traditions, and brought it down to the people. And this teaching, this idea that God is omnipresent in everyone's life, and you can connect to godliness even on your small level, becomes like the rage through many communities all throughout Eastern Europe. Now, the letter that you have in front of you is one of the foundational texts of Hasidus. It's a letter, I have here actually different Kisvei Yad, different written records of what this letter actually said, but we're going to use the English translation of Rav Aryeh Kaplan, who's an expert in Hasidus and in Kabbalah. This letter, the Baal Shem Tov's letter, was purportedly written to his brother-in-law, Rav Gershon Kitover, who lived in Israel. And here, in this letter, you get a sense of the Baal Shem Tov in terms of some of the foundational Hasidic principles. Number one, that there is a spiritual world. It's real. It's not only real, the Baal Shem Tov went there. And that not only is it real and that you can go there, it's that what your actions do in this physical world affect everything that goes on in the spiritual realms. and that everything, every person has a place of bringing godliness into the world. And these are some of the foundational teachings. That's what you have here is the letter where he describes that on Rosh Hashanah of 1746, he made an oath, he elevated his soul into the old upper worlds of Gan Eden. And then on the second column, he describes through the journey that he met the Mashiach. And this is a very well-known teaching among Chabad, where he asked the Mashiach, when will you come? When your wellsprings will be shared beyond. And this is the motivation for the emphasis in Mashiachiyut, in the messianism in Chabad, and their focus on sharing elsewhere. Not all Hasidim pick up on this, but it's very much influential in the world of Chabad. What's that? When the Mashiach said to him, when your Torah will abound. However, this was opposed strenuously by the Lithuanian Misnagdim, we could call them, the opposition to Hasidus, which was led by the Vilna Gaon, the genius Rav Elio of Vilna, and his disciple, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. And that's what you have on your page, the next page, Rav Chaim of Volozhin. I mention him. Someone said to me, how could you not quote the Vilna Gaon? Well, Rav Chaim Volozhin was the primary disciple of the Vilna Gaon. He was born in 1749. He dies in 1821. And in 1802, he founded the famous Yeshiva of Volozhin. And the Volozhin Yeshiva is essentially the head of all, I shouldn't say all, but almost all of today's contemporary modern yeshivot, Lithuanian yeshivas. And that's what you have here on this chart. Here is the Vilna Gaon. Here is Rav Chaim Volozhiner. This building still exists in Volozhin. He had a son, Rav Itzel Volozhiner, who had a son-in-law, who had two great disciples, who were both in Volozhin, the Netziv, Rav Nachman Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, the Beis HaLevi. And essentially today, if you talk about Tells, YU, Brisk, Lakewood, Chavetz Chaim, Neri Yisrael, Baltimore, America's Rav Kook, all of these places, they all come from one yeshiva. We're all one family. And that is our kind of Volozhin. All of us. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner creates the first, what we would call the modern yeshiva, and he writes a book that's published posthumously called the Nefesh HaChaim. Just think about it for a second. He creates this in 1802. At that time, I think John Adams was the president of the United States. Right? 1802? John Adams. So while John Adams is the president of the United States, Rav Chaim Volozhiner is setting up a tiny hut in a small town in near Vilna that's going to shape the world of Jewish learning. After he dies, the Nefesh HaChaim is published, and in here he has an important Shar Dalet, the fourth section, where he talks about the role of Torah study and what does it mean. And he says the following. If you look, I put it in two pages, A and B. He takes a not-so-subtle swipe at Hasidism. He says, now, in Avonoseinu Rabim, in our terrible sins, what's happening? Hafachu, everything is backwards. Hagavoa hushpal, the things that was high is now lowered. Shekama v'kamu somu kol ikar kvios limudim rova yomim rak besifra yira umusar. You know what people are doing now? Instead of learning Gemara, instead of learning Halacha, they're just learning Musar Svarim. They're just zugging Tehillim all day. They're saying Tehillim and they're saying, that's Torah learning. He says, ki ze ba'omram, they say, ze kol adam ba'olam alasuk b'em tamid. Why? Kihima malhivim halavavos. Because they get people excited. They move people spiritually, emotionally. So you know what everybody's doing? Everybody's just saying Tehillim and just reading ethical works. He says, what's going to happen? No one's studying real Torah. No one's studying classical learning. He says, I was traveling to different communities and I saw in such a place that in many of the Beis Medrashes, they only have Musar works. They don't even have a Shas. This is ridiculous. Says, you guys sitting and learning Tehillim all day, that's not real learning. What is real learning? What is Torah Lishma? That's the next page. B. I'm going to put the section B. Perek Gimel. Don't think that the reason we learn Torah is for dveikus, for cleaving to God, for clinging to God, for spiritual ecstasy. That's not the reason we learn. If that's the reason you learn, so good. Say Tehillim all day and you'll become very spiritual. Avala emes ki inyan lishma
The reason for learning Torah Lishma is what? L'shem HaTorah. It's just for the sake of Torah itself. V'daber b'hen l'shma. Kol diburcha u'masa'acha b'divrei Torah. All of your conversations in Torah learning, yiyeh l'shem HaTorah. Kagon leida, so that you should know. U'lahavin, you should understand. U'lahosif lekach u'pilpul, and you should add to the building and the edifice of knowledge of Torah. That is it. That's the purpose of learning. And that is going to be the foundational model of all future yeshivas. In a certain sense, Rav Schwarzschlita shared with me once, he said that kolim in Europe, they were extremely rare, very selective. Kovno, there was a famous kol, the first one, the end of the 19th century. So he says, in those days, the sole purpose was just Torah Lishma. The whole idea of me being in a kolel and me sharing learning out in a community, that's not the way it was. He says, today we need a different model, but in those days, Torah Lishma was just for the sake of learning. It was exclusively learning for the sake of learning, and it meant learning Gemara, and in Voloshin they started Daf Beis, and they went straight. There's no skipping, there's no jumping around, it's just learning from the beginning straight through to the end of Shas. As opposed to Hasidus, which is emphasizing Dveikus and connecting people to godliness. Here, it's emphasizing Torah for the sake of Torah study. Okay, we move now away from Lithuania and Ukraine to Hungary, to the Chasam Sofer. Chasam Sofer is born in Frankfurt, but he spends much of his life in Hungary. He's born in 1762, dies in 1839, so I guess at that point, Abraham Lincoln is probably just becoming a state senator or something. I don't know exactly what he was doing in the 1830s, but this was a good time. I think Andrew Jackson was probably the president during the life of the Chasam Sofer. His two very important rabbeim in Frankfurt, one was Rav Nussan Adler, who is a great scholar and a Kabbalist, as well as Rav Pinchas Halevi Horowitz, the author of the Haflah of the Machne, a great Talmudic scholar. And that's where he was raised until he settles in Pressburg and he establishes the largest yeshiva in Hungary. For 33 years he led the yeshiva in Pressburg in Hungary, which is the greatest yeshiva, the biggest yeshiva since the Babylonian period. The Chasam Sofer, the word Sofer is also Schreiber. That's, if you see people's Yiddish name, Yiddish is Schreiber, it comes from the word Sofer. That's why it's called Rav Moshe Sofer. His name is Schreiber. And he became the leader of Hungarian, and then we can call it Orthodox Judaism. And he led the struggle to maintain traditional halachic Judaism in the face of the onslaught, the tidal wave of reform, the nascent reforms that were going on in Germany. And this tshuva that you see in front of you, tshuva chavches, from the tshuva zachasim sofer, is kind of emblematic of this discussion. Rav Schwartz told me, Shalita, that he heard from Rav Soloveitchik that the Chasam Sofer was the engineer of halacha. That's what Rav Soloveitchik said about the Chasam Sofer. Why? What is an engineer? Somebody who knows every component of a building, of a circuit. He knows what they do and how they fit together. And he organizes them in a way that create an integrated process. So Rav Soloveitchik, apparently, the way he viewed the Chasam Sofer is that the Chasam Sofer knew everything about the world of halacha and how it all interrelated, and his tshuvas organized all of that. This is the responsa. So the question that's raised here was a question about a shul that was doing renovations, and they wanted to move the bima from the middle of the shul to the front of the shul. Is that permitted? Well, it doesn't say anywhere in the Shas, in the Talmud, where you need to put the bima. Doesn't say. The Rambam, and that's what he writes here on the right-hand column, in Hilchos Tefillah, the paragraph begins, Lefnei, third line, Bon in Teva be'emtza be'is HaKnesses, kedei sheyishmu'u kulam b'shaveh. The Rambam says, you put the bima in the middle of the shul so that everyone can hear well. Okay. What if you want to put the bima in the front and everybody can hear fine? Says the Chasam Sofer, absolutely not.
The minug in this shul is that the bima goes in the middle. The minug in all the shuls is that the bima goes in the middle. You may not change. And then he finishes with a line that appears in several of his tshuvas that becomes axiomatic for the Chasam Sofer. You see where the line is toward the end. And the underline, v'haklal, and the rule is, hechadash asur min ha-Torah. What's that paraphrasing? It's paraphrasing a law that has to do with new grain that grew. Okay. What does that have to do with anything? So Chadash is new grain that grew that didn't have the Korban Omer yet to allow it. Chasam Sofer is borrowing that legal term that has something to do with Chadash. And we mentioned the great Tzaddik, the Gaon, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, Zichron Levracha, because we're in Chicago, who is very makbid not to eat Chadash, to only eat Yashan. And that became a thing in Chicago more than other cities in America. Chadash was and Yashan. The Chasam Sofer adopted that phrase and he translated it to something else. To the general concept that chadash meaning innovation. Innovation is prohibited. Why did he do that? Because he was trying to stave off the innovations of the reform movement. Rav Schwartz mentioned once that Rav Soloveitchik gave a drasha. He heard the Rav's drasha. He quoted an earlier chacham about the reform movement. The first thing they did was they took out the Yukum Purkan paragraph from the davening. So the Rav Soloveitchik said about this, Vayimach Eskol Hayikum, which is a pasuk in Parashas Noach that describes that God, the waters of the flood, wiped out all of the Yikum, everything that existed. It wiped it out. So that was the Rav's way of saying that by taking away Yukum Purkan, that one tefillah, as part of their reform movement, it wiped out all of orthodoxy. That was no longer considered orthodox. Vayimach Eskol Hayikum. And that's the Chodesh HaSem HaTorah, the approach of the Chasam Sofer. The last person in this segment who we'll meet is another Jew, another great rabbi, living in Frankfurt. And his name is Rav Shimshon Rafal Hirsch. Born in 1808, dies in 1888. He was born in Hamburg, and he started with his grandfather, Rav Mendel Frankfurter. His major teachers was the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, Chacham Bernays, Rav Yitzchak Bernays, as well as Rav Yaakov Edlinger, the author of the Orach Laner and the Binyan Zion and the Minchas Ani, very, very important rabbinic scholars. And Rav Hirsch does something fascinating. And this will be the last one of this segment. We'll take a literally 1 minute break, and then we'll have the last 20 minutes for our last segment. Rav Hirsch, on the one hand, is struggling to deal with reform. And what he does is something amazing, is that he creates what's called the Austrit. The technical term was called the Austrit Gemeinde. In those days, the German government recognized a semi-autonomous, like the Jewish council, the Jewish community. And so in Frankfurt and in Hamburg, these communities were run by Reform Jews. So Rav Hirsch petitioned the government, and they ultimately enacted a law in 1876 to allow the Orthodox, the traditional Torah Jews, to secede from the Jewish community. It was called the Law of the Secession, Austrittsgesetz. And so Rav Hirsch actually created, toward the end of his life, he created a separatist movement with its own institutions, its own shuls, and its own schools that were strictly Orthodox. So on the one hand, you'll say that Rav Hirsch was a separatist, which he was. But on the other hand, he created a very important educational philosophy. And that educational philosophy is called, he called it, Torah im Derech Eretz. In 1854, he published a pamphlet, and I gave you two pieces of this pamphlet, called Der Religion im Bund mit dem Vorschrift. Vorschrift. It's a very lengthy essay, where he responds to the accusations of some of the quote-unquote enlightened progressive Jews making fun of Rav Hirsch's academies, his Talmidim, and his schools, and his method. Says Rav Hirsch, he says, no. You don't understand. I have a very fundamental disagreement with you. You believe in something called religion allied with progress. You want to see progress. You want to see modernity. Remember, this is after the Enlightenment. We're in Germany. You want to see progress, modernism. And along with that, you want to see religion. He says, I don't agree with that. I want to see religion all allied with
progress. I want to see the religion playing the central role. And you know what? It's not a stira. You don't have to reject modernism to believe in religion. But in the bottom of page 120, Judaism was never alien to genuine civilization and culture. In almost every era, its followers stood at the very heights of the culture of their day. Indeed, they often outstripped their contemporaries in this respect. If in recent centuries the German Jews were made more or less alien to European culture, the fault lay not in their religion, but in the coercion, the tyranny from the outside that forcibly confined them to the alleys of their ghettos and shut them off. He says, we don't have to shun the light, quote, of the world or the critical eye of their contemporaries. We don't have to smoke cigars on Shabbos to be enlightened and still be Jewish and still be observant. The curriculum of our school, bottom of 121, seeks to promote a well-rounded education in keeping with the standards of our age on a level with any other secondary school. And this objective is not impeded in any way by the fact that at the same time, care is taken to give the students a thorough grounding in Jewish religious studies. Next page, 122. Top of the page. The motto of our religious, I don't know how to pronounce that, whatever that is, religionschaft, Yafet Talmud Torah im Derech Eretz. What we want is progress allied with religion. To us, religion is the absolute on which progress depends. This is Rav Hirsch's philosophy, Torah im Derech Eretz. We have to be serious about the religion. Religion is central. It plays the pivotal role in defining who we are. But that doesn't mean that we cannot embrace and we can't involve progress and be part of the modern society. Okay, the time is now. So for the last segment, we'll spend our last 20-25 minutes on the last 200 years. And here too, how can you choose? If you had to pick five figures. So we begin with the Chafetz Chaim, Rav Yisrael Meir HaKohen of Radin, who, he was born in the 1830s, he died in the 1930s, we don't know exactly, over 100, we don't know exactly how long, but certainly one of the most saintly figures in modern Judaism. He didn't want to make the Rabbonus a calling, so he actually had a little store, a grocery store that he and his wife managed. She ran the store, he did the books, until ultimately so many people flocked to his house that it became the Radner Yeshiva. The Chafetz Chaim essentially revolutionized the concept of Shmiras HaLashon himself personally in 1873 when the book Chafetz Chaim was published. He was only 35 years old. It was an anonymous work on the importance of Shmiras HaLashon, but he also published other very important works. He published over 20 volumes, including Machane Yisrael, which was published in 1881, which was a practical code of law for Jewish soldiers who had been conscripted by the Tsar's army. And he wrote a sefer called Avas Chesed on the study of Chesed. And he oversaw the writing of the Mishneh Brura, which is the massive work that's become increasingly and incredibly popular and authoritative on all of Or HaChaim. However, one aspect of the Chafetz Chaim that I think it bears mention is that the Chafetz Chaim wrote a kuntres called Tzipisa LeYeshua about the importance of looking forward, the mitzvah of anticipating the Geula and the Mashiach. Chafetz Chaim lived with the reality, the consciousness that we were literally on the doorstep of the coming of the Mashiach. And therefore, he says, we have to orient ourselves to this concept of redemption. He says, we're living in the ikvus of the Mashiach. And so it's not shocking to me that the Chafetz Chaim had another work that's called Likutei Halachos. The Chafetz Chaim wrote a commentary on the works of Kodshim, on the temple sacrifices. The Chafetz Chaim insisted that people learn this Limud. And not only that, he actually published other works. It's called the Asifa Zekanim. It's a collection of other rabbinic commentaries on the works of Kodshim. Because for the Chafetz Chaim, you needed to live with the sense that the Mashiach is going to be coming soon. You got to be prepared. What's the service going to be like in the Beis HaMikdash? So an area of Torah study that had been basically neglected for centuries, he single-handedly revolutionized the study of the Limud of Kodshim. So the piece I gave you is actually
part of the Hakadamah, the introduction to the Asifa Sekenim. We all think, when we think of Chavetz Chaim, we think of Shemiras HaLashon. People think, we think of Chavetz Chaim, we think of the Mishneh Berurah. But we also need to think about the idea of Geula, of looking forward to the Geula and the study of Kodshim. The Chavetz Chaim has like a 13-page introduction. This is Asifa Sekenim. But before that, he gives you just a little modah. And that's what you have in front of you. Just a little, like a teaser, a trailer. Hine yadua mechachameinu zal. It is known from our great sages. Shifligu ma'od es limud inyani ha'avodah shibis ma'chibis ha'mikdash. That they praised the learning of the sections that were the service in the Beis HaMikdash. Shakadosh Baruch Hu mala zeh ki'ilu hikrif ha'karbonos mamish. It's as if we offer the sanctity, the sacrifices. So for example, if I learn the laws of Shabbos candles, it's not as if I lit Shabbos candles. It's a fulfillment of Talmud Torah. But when I learn the laws of sacrifices, it's as if I brought the sacrifices. V'gam mekariv b'zeis ha-ge'ula, says the Chavetz Chaim, it brings the ge'ula closer to us. And then he says, I'm going to write a whole kuntres about this. V'im kein, halfway through the second line, ha-yoroi shekol ish Yisrael yaktish ma'at me'itos of limud seder ha-kadshim. Everybody, all Jews, should spend a little bit of time learning Kodshim. And through that, we could take this, which was a dormant book, and transform it into something living. So the Chavetz Chaim himself wrote a commentary called Likutei Halachos, and he also collected these teachings of the Asifa Zekenim. For the Chavetz Chaim, the Geula, it was a reality, not just a concept. It was a way to live and a way to learn. It was just a unique aspect of his personality that's not often focused on for this person who is known as a tremendous tzaddik. And for those who have seen, if you haven't seen, Google it, please. You could see the picture and the video of the Chavetz Chaim from his attending the Vienna conference of the Agudas Yisrael. I think it was 1923. It's now out, thanks to the University of, I think it was South Carolina. You could see it. If you haven't seen it, Google it. It's an amazing footage. You see a few seconds of the Chavetz Chaim walking. Our second figure, we needed to find someone for the story of the Torah that was lost in the Holocaust. There is an incredible encyclopedia of seven volumes that some have heard me talk about many times. It's called Ela Ezkara. Ela Ezkara, seven volumes, seven huge books, and it's devoted to one topic. It's biographies of great rabbinic luminaries who were murdered by the Germans in the Holocaust. That's all it is. It fills seven volumes, biographies of great Hasidic masters, Admorim, Lithuanian rabbis, community rabbis, Rosh Yeshivas, and they span the gamut all throughout Eastern Europe. It's overwhelming, it's mind-boggling to even imagine the amount of Torah knowledge, the worlds of Torah that were destroyed during the Holocaust. So I wanted to share with you one individual who kind of bridges some of the divides between Hasidim and Misnagdim. His name was Rav Menachem Zemba. He was born in 1883. He lived in Praga. Praga is a suburb of Warsaw. Not Prague in Czech, but Praga. And he was known as the Prager Eloi, the genius from Praga. As a young man, his father died, and so he was raised by the Polish Hasidim in the community. So he was raised as a Polish chassid, a ger chassid, but he was educated in the classic Lithuanian yeshiva model. So he's a bridge between the two worlds of chassidim and misnagdim. He was known as a genius, and for 20 years he just stayed in learning, and he was supported after he got married by his father-in-law until 1917, when his father-in-law died and he had to take over the business, which tanked. At that point, he had to get a parnassa, so he moved to Warsaw and he became a member of the Warsaw Rabbinical Council. He was a tremendous chacham, and he was the secretary of the Agudas Yisrael on the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. Rav Menachem Zemba wrote 10,000 pages of commentaries on the Torah. Primarily two massive manuscripts. One was called Menachem Yerushalayim on the Talmud Yerushalmi, which is extremely rare to find commentaries on the Yerushalmi. And he also wrote a massive commentary on the Rambam called Machazel HaMelech. These commentaries, these huge works, were destroyed, were lost in the Warsaw Ghetto.
Rabbi Nachum Zemba was living in Warsaw 1939 when the Germans came after 6 weeks of Blitzkrieg. The ghetto was established and Rabbi Nachum Zemba was there. And there's the Dr. Hillel Seidman who wrote the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, who Rabbi Schwartz told me once that he met and he knew Dr. Seidman. Hillel Seidman records several interactions that he had with Rabbi Nachum Zemba. Rabbi Nachum Zemba was in charge. He was one of several rabbis who ran a series of underground yeshivas in bunkers and sewers in the ghetto. So they had boys who learned in different little places, and Rabbi Nachum would go from place to place to give them chizuk and to give them bechinas, to test them in their learning. Hillel Seidman describes that at one point, Rabbi Nachum Zemba, he says, had to move apartments 5 times because of the shifting in the ghetto. And at one point, during Sukkot, he lived in the upstairs flat of an apartment building, and he busted open a piece of the roof to make a kosher sukkah. So Hillel Seidman describes that hundreds of people came through the apartment just to sit for a minute in the apartment of Rabbi Nachum Zemba to make a leisha basukkah, to sit in the sukkah in the ghetto. It's unbelievable, his heroism, amazing. Now, we do have 2 svarim from Rabbi Nachum Zemba. One is a collection of letters that he had exchanged with other great rabbis. It's called the Shalos Teshuva Zera Avraham, and a work on Masechet Shabbos called Totzos Chaim. But everything else was lost. There was some discussion. He could have gotten out. He didn't get out. What's amazing about Rabbi Nachum Zemba, it's unique. Not everybody in the rabbinical community agreed with him, but what you have here on your page is a selection from Rabbi Nachum Zemba's biography authored by Shmuel Yitzchak Rothstein, where he quotes Dr. Hillel Seidman from a meeting that took place in the winter, January of 1943, as there was talk of a Warsaw Ghetto uprising. And Hillel Seidman describes the talk that Rav Menachem Zemba gave to sanction the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. Go to line 26. I'm not going to read the whole thing because of time. Says Rav Menachem Zemba, 26, Yesh drachim shonos l'kiddush Hashem. I'm on number 98, page 98, line 26. There are different ways, paths in kiddush Hashem. If they forced us to convert today, next page, the left-hand column, if we could baptize like in the Crusades or in the Spanish expulsion, if we died then we would call it a Kiddush Hashem. Harambam posik afilu shebishah sheyehudi nerak mishum yehud shehu yehudi hari ze bilvad kiddush Hashem v'halacha kamoso. The Rambam rules that if a Jew dies just because he's a Jew, that's also a kiddush Hashem, and that's how we paskin. Who's he reflecting on? He's reflecting on the hundreds of thousands of Jews who were taken away by train before him from the ghetto, who were murdered by the Nazis. Ach, he says, Kayom Hazeh, this day, in 1943, Haderach Hayechida Lekadosh Es Hashem, He Hisnagdus Mizuyenes Befoal. It is armed resistance against the Germans. In this one paragraph, Rabbi Nachum encapsulates 2 kinds of heroism, 2 kinds of Kiddush Hashem. The Kiddush Hashem of those Jews who died just because they were Jews, because the Nazis murdered them, but also those Jews who stood up. And that's today. I mean, there's a lot of historical controversy about Yom HaShoah, but it's called Yom HaShoah VaHagvura. It's trying to commemorate both the martyrdom of the Jews who were murdered and also those who resisted. So when did the uprising break out? It broke out on Erev Pesach, in 1943, and it was Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach in 1943 that Rabbi Nachum Zemba was running from one burning building to another when he was gunned down. And he lay there in the street. They couldn't take him on Shabbos to be buried, but Motzoi Shabbos, when it got dark, they buried him in the ghetto. And in 1958, his kever was found, and he was reinterred in Yerushalayim in Har HaMenuchos, where he is buried today. So this is one figure of many, many figures we could talk about from the learning of those who were murdered by the Nazis in the Holocaust. We turn now
to a different stream, a different aspect of Torah learning from the last century, and that is the community of religious Zionism. And I did not choose Rav Kook because Rav Kook is so well known. I wanted to pick a figure who was a little bit lesser well known, but also a critical person in the development of our Masorah that we share in this room of the Torah of Medinat Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. And that is the Gaon Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. He was born in 1888 in Lomsha, which was a very important town of Lomdim. But at the age of 9, his father, Rav Yoel Herzog, became the rabbi in Leeds in England. And then Rav Herzog began self-study. He was a self-taught, obviously he was a tremendous gaon, a tremendous genius. He received smicha after he studied by himself from Ridvaz, and a doctorate of literature by the London University for his thesis, which was called The Dyeing of Purple in Ancient Israel, also known as Tcheles. So Rav Herzog was a gaon in Choshen Mishpat. He actually wrote, if you're ever interested, he wrote two volumes in English called The Main Institutions of Jewish Law. Imagine, for the lawyers, this is really important. Imagine trying to explain Choshen Mishpat to non-Jews. It's very difficult because the concepts are so abstract and they're so unique, like Kinyonim. And he has two volumes in English explaining all of Choshen Mishpat. So if you ever want to give somebody a gift and want to understand what is Choshen Mishpat, he is in English, he wrote. I think he knew like 7 languages. He was self-taught. He was self-taught. So he wrote his doctoral dissertation on the chilazon, on identifying what is tcheles. And so it happens to be that the tcheles that I'm wearing right now is actually what Rav Herzog figured out, but he abandoned it because in his experiments it didn't go right. And the whole chap is that today the guys who are making the tcheles, not the Radziner tcheles, which he discusses, the guys who are making the tcheles today in Israel, they say that it's the Murex trunculus, which Rav Herzog figured out. But when Rav Herzog did his experiments, it came out purple, not blue. So he said, well, it can't be, because it has to be blue. What did these guys now, Sturman and Greenspan, all these guys who are doing tcheles now, they had an accidental revelation. If they use Rav Herzog's tcheles dye outside in the sun, it turns blue. And that's how the Murex trunculus is blue and not purple. So that's the tcheles that I'm wearing, that Rav Schechter wears and many other poskim wear. It comes from the same tcheles that Rav Herzog had figured out. Then he abandoned it because it didn't look blue to him. But that's because it wasn't done in the sunshine. And if you think about it, in ancient Israel, where were they doing it? They were doing it outside. So that's how it easily became tcheles. In 1935, Rav Kook passes away, and Rav Herzog is named as the chief rabbi in the malamokum of Rav Kook. So I have at home a memorial volume to Rav Herzog that collects manuscripts of speeches that he gave, and they're so fascinating, so varied. One of them is in the inauguration of King George, because at that time it was the British mandate. And so he gave a shir, a sicha, in honor of King George, and many other very interesting sichot. After the war, in 1945, Rav Herzog traveled through Europe, knocking on doors of convents, trying to find Jewish kids, being active in bringing them out from whether they were convents or other non-Jewish homes that had been taking in these kids. So he was extremely active after the war. There's a lot to say about that. But I wanted to share with you here is a sicha that Rav Herzog gave July 27th, 1948. Chav Tammuz Tav Shin Ches, the anniversary, the 44th yard site of Herzl. So Herzl, although he did have a very distinguished-looking beard, he was anything but rabbinic. Let's just say that. So how do you relate to a secular man like Herzl? So one way is to say, you know, off the reservation, you have nothing to say, we can't relate to him, he's not observant. Or you could take the view that Rav Kook had and Rav Moliver and others from the Mizrahi community and say, look, we have to try to tease out that which is good, that which is constructive, that which is important from a Torah standpoint from this movement of secular Zionism. So we need to work with them in that which we can have common ground. So this is a yard site shir from the chief rabbi who is a gaon atzum for Herzl, a secular Jew. And he describes on the third line, today is the Yom HaZikaron of Herzl. He died before 44 years. The one who came up with the concept of Medinas Yisrael, Dr. Herzl, Zichrono Levracha. And he says, I remember him in my mind. And when he died on line 5, he says, we were all afraid. What were we afraid? That with the death of Herzl would also be the death of the Zionist idea. But thank God that didn't happen. And now we see that this man, Herzl, line 9, who was a Shaliach Me'es Hashgacha Elyona, Yehi Zichro Baruch La'adish, memory should be a blessing. He was an agent of Hashem to help us establish what we have today is the Medinas Yisrael. Wait a second. How old is Medinas Yisrael when this is written?
2 months.
That's right. So he writes, unbelievable, he says, today, these days, he's writing in the 3 weeks, so he says, they're Yemei Bein HaMitzarim. On the one hand, they're sad days, on the other, they are happy days. He says, we look at line 9, line 15. He reads the words of Yirmiyahu. Haloch v'karos v'ozni v'shalayim leimar kormar Hashem zacharti l'ches and yirayach. Who will wake you up from the dead, Yirmiyahu? If you came from your grave, what would you say about what you see today? You would say probably in line 16, zacharti l'chesed zikunayach. Think about the gifts that God did for us and the relationship we had with Him, not in our early days in the desert, in the later days in the desert, in 1948, in the desert of the Negev, in the founding of the state, 2,000 years later. Now look at this. The state is waking up. We have a state, we have a tzava, line 21, but it's not all rose. It's not perfect. We're still fighting. We still have enemies around us who are trying to destroy us and kill us. We can't say Hashem has given us rest. Go to the next page, 206. V'Yerushalayim mahi be'elu hayomim. What about Yerushalayim? So what was Yerushalayim in those days? It was in Jordanian hands. So it's amazing. He says, Yeshla lemedinas Yisrael medinaim. We have a country. Yeshla cabinet. Sarim v'yoatzim. Umein parliament. A quasi-parliament. Why does he say we have a quasi-parliament? Because it was only transitional government. They hadn't even established the Knesset yet. This was just the transitional government until January of 1949, when the first Knesset was formally elected. Amazing. He says, Ein zeh third line, ki im beis elokim, v'zeh karov l'shar ha-shamayim, karov l'kotel ha-ma'aravi. He's writing in 1948. He's speaking on the University of Herzl's death. He says, we're so close to Kotel. What would he say now? What would Rav Herzog say now? Rav Herzog died in 1959. What would he have said if he could see? He says, today we have the Kotel. Amazing. And we'll end, he says, imagine what we'll conclude, number 24, line 24, Nesayim with the words of Navi Kodesh Yisrael Hashem Reishis Tevuasa. Our goal is that we should have a Medinas Yisrael with its Tzava, which is amazing, all gifts of God, on that Yisod, filled with godliness. That is the idea of Torat Eretz Yisrael. That's the idea that Rav Kook bespoke, that the Mizrachim bespoke, that our community celebrates, and given in a yardside shir, yardside drasha, in memory of Herzl. We move over to the American scene, and we conclude with two giants. The first one is the Gaon Rav Aaron Cutler. Now, if we were talking about Israel, maybe we should have chosen the Chazon Ish, but being that we live in America, Rav Aaron Cutler, who was the founder of the Lakewood Yeshiva-based Medrash Gavoy, was born in 1892. He fits, if you take a look afterwards, he gets fees. The son-in-law of Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. He was a student of Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein at the age of 14 in Slobodka. Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Slobodka Yeshiva, was relocated to Hebron in the beginning of the 20th century. And it stayed in Hebron until the massacres of the yeshiva and the Hebron Jewish community in 1929 in Tarpat. Then the Hebron yeshiva moved to Yerushalayim. So now there are two Hebron yeshivas, but the primary one is in Givat Mordechai. It's called Knesset Yisrael. It was before Givat Mordechai, it was in Hebron. Before it was in Hebron, it was in Slobodka. And that's where Rav Aaron Cutler learned as a young man. During the war, he escaped through Japan and arrived in America, and he essentially rebuilt the world of learning that was. He established essentially the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah of the Agudah, Chinuch HaTzmoi, and what we know today, let's say the Chicago Community Kollel, is called Zichron Schneer after Schneer Cutler, who was the son of Rav Aaron Cutler, the Lakewood community has changed the landscape of American Jewry. Where does this come from? So what you have in your packet here is a piece from the Mishnas Rav Aaron, which is a translation of the Sicha that Rav Aaron Cutler gave when he first arrived in America. And he tells us in this work what is his goal. He's arriving now in 1941, 1942. He's going to establish his life's work. He says, I want to thank you people for the Agudas HaRabbonim and the Vada HaTzala for everything that you've done. But for the purpose of time, go to the second page. What's our job? Our job, first of all, number line 28, to Aretz Hazos, Artes Abris, meaning America, La'es Hazos, Yayechida, Darka Ve'ela, Nitan LaHatzilam. Umikan Godel Ho'achrayas Al Roa Yisrael Be'eretz Hazos V'Laklal Kulo. Our first job as Americans is to save the Jews of Europe. We have to do whatever we can, which means even on Shabbos, Chilul Shabbos, Pikuach Nefesh, which he did, to try to save Jews from the clutches of the Nazis. And in addition, line 34, Mutelas Aleinu Hachov Alasus Kachol Yol Kolteinu. We have to do everything we can to do what? Almanas Lintoa Es Ole HaTorah. To replant, to reestablish the tents of Torah, Bitzivyonon, in their style, Bidmusan, in their image, Ubekomosan, in their stature, Hamaleim Vamakorim, Kan Be'eretzu Artzosabris. Our job, says Rav Aaron Cutler, is to reestablish the yeshivas of Europe in America. If you want to understand the culture and the vision of the Lakewood community of Beis Medrash Gavoah, it's from their founder. It's from Rav Aaron Cutler, who said their task was to replant and to establish the yeshiva system today in his model of the Torah institutions of Eastern Europe. And that is essentially the roadmap for many of the communities that we see today in America. It's this guiding principle of reestablishing the yeshivas exactly as they were in Eastern Europe before the war. And these were Torah-only institutions, no secular studies. The Volozhin Yeshiva itself, at the end, in the 1880s, the Netziv was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. He closed the yeshiva, so there's some question exactly why and how, but there definitely was pushback. The Russians were trying to instigate some secular studies to be introduced in the yeshiva. There was some question whether they shouldn't. Ultimately, they decided to close the yeshiva. And this is Rav Aaron Cutler trying to reestablish the classic model of the Lithuanian yeshivas in Europe after the decimation in the war. And we conclude with the Masorah that I was benefited by and from which I still am nourished to this moment, and that is Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, which was established, by the way, in the end of the 19th century. YU, the first, it was called the yeshiva. The yeshiva was called Eitz Chaim. Why was it called Eitz Chaim? Because the Volozhin Yeshiva was called Eitz Chaim. The Volozhin Yeshiva was called Eitz Chaim. Why? Because of Rav Chaim Volozhiner. When Rav Chaim Volozhiner died, they called the yeshiva Eitz Chaim. So in the 1800s, when they started the yeshiva in New York, they called it Eitz Chaim because the yeshiva was the Volozhin Yeshiva. It was only in 1896, with the death of Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, the great Gaon, the Kovner Rav, the Posek Ador, they renamed the yeshiva Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. But it was really based on the Lithuanian yeshiva, the Volozhin Yeshiva. So Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan was led by Dr. Revel and then by Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. Rav Moshe Halevi Soloveitchik, the son of Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, the great Talmudic genius, the revolutionary. His brother was Rav Yitzchak Halevi Soloveitchik from Brisk, and they were from Yerushalayim. So he had a son, his name is Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, he had another son who was here in Chicago, Rav Aaron Halevi Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik was a towering personality, one of the giant figures in Rabbinic Judaism, in Torah Judaism, and in all of Judaism in the 20th century. He passed away not too long ago in 1993, but he had a student, a disciple, and a son-in-law who just passed away just a few weeks ago, who I had the privilege and the zchus of having the opportunity to learn with, to know. I can't say I knew him. How could you? It's like, I gave this marshal several times. You take someone who's never been to Chicago, you take them to the foot of the Willis Tower, and you say, how tall is it? So that's what it was like being near Rav Lichtenstein. How tall is it? You can't tell how tall it is. Rav Lichtenstein was such a giant. The experience of coming to the shiur every week, when Nechama and I were first married, we lived in Yerushalayim, we went to, I was in the Grus Kolol, so Rav Lichtenstein used to give two shiurim. First to give a shiur in Machshava, and that year we're learning Sanhedrin, so he spoke about Perek Chelek. Nechama came to the shiur, she sat in the back, she was the only one woman who came to the shiur, and then she went home, and he gave the Gemara shiur. And I went to the Gemara shiur, and very often I would come home and I would say, I think I understood a quarter of what he was saying. I didn't really understand much of what he said there. I wasn't used to the style of learning, and also it was so beyond where I was. But I went just to be mechitzaso shel adam gadol in the presence of a giant, just to watch him daven ma'ariv, just to see him learn. His hekif, it was just unbelievable. And so I thought that someone would say, how could you not use this one? How could you not use that one? I thought to represent the idea, the philosophy of our community that's embodied and. And Rav Lichtenstein, even though he went on Aliyah in 1971, he still maintained a very strong connection to YU. Over the years, not just in Grus, but in general, he was very connected. And the whole Masorah that we have of the tradition of being able to synthesize so many things in the world through the prism of Torah, that's the philosophy of Rav Lichtenstein. That's what I wanted to close with. Rav Lichtenstein was just a unique and towering figure in his piety, in his knowledge, in his analysis, in his whole, his courage, so many different aspects. And this week, Mirtz Hashem, we have two special programs. Tuesday night, we're having a special program in memory. It's the Yahrzeit. Tuesday night is the Yahrzeit of the three boys, Gilad, Ayal, and Naftali. So that's going to be Tuesday night. Ray Greenland is going to talk about Avos Yisrael at the Wi-Fi building. There's a very powerful little video we're going to show. And then Wednesday night, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein is going to come and speak about his father, who will be here in our Torah. I wanted to close the whole shiur, this whole presentation, with one piece of Rav Lichtenstein. Because Rav Lichtenstein is, it's so vast, it's so complex. It's hard to know exactly how many hands Rav Lichtenstein had. Because we wondered, maybe he was an octopus. Because every time it's, well, on one hand, and then on the other hand, then on the other hand, on the other hand, who knows, he had so many hands. And the nuance and the complexity which marked Rav Lichtenstein's Torah is impossible to convey in one little piece. But Rav Chaim Sabato did us a big favor. He went and he sat with Rav Lichtenstein and says, basically, Rav Lichtenstein, we want to explain your life, your life's work, your hashkafa to the regular Joes like me and you. It's so hard to read sometimes. Rav Lichtenstein is so sophisticated, so lofty. So I'm going to interview you, and I'm going to ask you questions, and you're going to give me answers, and I'm going to write it out like a regular person would try to understand. And this became a sefer called Mevakshe Panecha. It's an amazing work where it distills a lot of Rav Lichtenstein's ideas into regular, everyday people like me and you can understand them. Amazing. So I want to share with you three quotes. And this is everything that Rav Lichtenstein stood for, and it's everything that we all stand for, and that's the whole purpose of this whole shiur. Ani chai betchusha, I live with a sense, shemibchinati, from my vantage point, hargoshas hakeshar im HaKadosh Baruch Hu, hi amina yoser, virialis yoser, mikol dover acher sha'an yochol lachshov alav. I live with a sense, with a feeling, that my connection with Hashem, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is more true and more real than anything else that I can consider. I feel a closeness to Hashem more than anything else. Hazika hayichudis hazos laKadosh Baruch Hu. This unique connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu mevia l'romamus ruach. It brings to an uplifting of the spirit. Romamus haruach, uplifting of the spirit, she'odam margish, Be'ikvos haziko hazos, that a person feels with this uplifting sense, he mamad amiti im shorashim amitiim. The high, the spiritual elevation that a person feels in their connection to Hashem is true, with true roots. Kishim shenochon adavar biyachas l'sheli l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, just like it's true in my relationship, in my connection to Hashem, to God, it's also true in my relationship and my connection to Torah. HaTorah, the Torah, Devar Hashem Hi. It is the Word of God. Lefichach, therefore, Hamaga Sheli BaTorah, my connection to Torah, Humaga Akif Im HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a circumscribed connection with Hashem, with the Almighty. Mikan, from this, Novas osa tchusha miyuchedes. From this, from Torah, emerges this incredible, unique feeling of exaltedness, b'limud haTorah, in the study of Torah. Tchusha yichudes zo, this unique feeling, this unique sense, mafre, it blossoms, mezina, it nourishes, umeatzeves, and it shapes, es isuki b'Torah, my engagement with Torah. Hi matvas es chosama, it leaves its imprint, al kol olami, on my whole world. That's the impact of Torah. The impact with the Dvar Hashem, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the goal, and this is what we see, that when we study Torah today, we are part of all of that, of the incredible chain of Masorah, of these great Gaonim, of the amount of Torah, the wisdom, the spirit, and the Romamus HaRuach, that's something that's going to leave an imprint on all of us. And hopefully, through this experience, we've learned, but we've also felt that Romamus HaRuach that Rav Lichtenstein speaks about. Yashikoach.